this episode, Justice League America number 52 and Justice League Europe number 28, cover dated July 1991. Hello, and welcome to the 52nd episode of Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name is the Iridium Shag, and I am your host, but guess what? I have brought along some friends. In fact, each episode, I invite two different guest hosts to help me tackle a couple of issues of JLI. Now, we'll chat with my second co-host in just a bit, but for now, my first co-host today is a longtime listener, first-time caller, and he was the first JLI cosplayer to get in touch with me once I started the JLI podcast. His Ted Kord Blue Beetle cosplay is awesome. He also does a fantastic Jack Knight Starman. He does a Ben Reilly Scarlet Spider. He does Ghostbusters. He does so much more. Now he just needs to stop being lazy and figure out how to cosplay both Blue Beetle and Booster Gold at the same time. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Joe Tonello. Welcome to the New York Embassy, Joe. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Well, the answer to that first question is very, very easy. I simply just do not have the butt to be doing either Gold Beetle.
Know your limits. Know your limits.
Yes. Mr. Kord, I wonder what that screaming is. I'll worry about that later. So, Kord, I loaded the hyperhelium into the bug like you asked, and it leaked. I need to know how long I'm going to sound like this. Like, it's terrible. I sound like a chipmunk.
Is that because the hyperhelium that's done this to you?
Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that. That's got to be a horrible affliction.
It is. It really is. So, hey, buddy, quick question.
Yeah, what's up?
Hey, I recognize you. Aren't you Booster Gold?
No, I'm not Booster Gold. I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
Really? By choice?
Yes, by choice. I'm the Irredeemable Shag. If I were Booster Gold, I'd be wearing gold now, wouldn't I?
Huh. My folks are right. Superheroes really did run out of names in the 1970s.
Would you like my autograph?
Sure. Quick question.
Yeah.
Why does this say to Wendy from Supermarv?
Oh, give me that one back. Okay, let's just move on. Let's just move on. That is from my private collection. But anyway.
Gotcha.
Well, Joe, I hope the hyperhelium wears off at some point, at least before your retirement. So.
We've been 39 years and counting, so.
Well, I could make fun of Joe all day, and I have done it, by the way, in person over dinner before, and it's a lot of fun, but...
It's very easy, too.
It's like shooting fish in a barrel. But before we do too much of that, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI Podcast is sponsored by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we'll pick a collected edition to discuss from the InStockTrades library. And usually it's tied in that issue in some way, shape, or fashion. Mine's a bit of a stretch, but I am on a huge Daredevil kick right now. My wife and I were rewatching Daredevil Season 3. I've been reading a bunch of Daredevil comics. So I picked Daredevil Epic Collection Trade Paperback Heart of Darkness. You're probably wondering, what does Daredevil have to do with this issue? Quite frankly, nothing. However, his dad is a boxer. So that's my tangential connection, is that Battling Jack Murdock is a boxer. So there we go. So this particular Epic Collection, which, by the way, the Marvel's Epic Collections are truly epic. They're amazing. So anyway, this one collects a lot of the Daredevils from the 90s. It's primarily the Ann Nesenti run, the back half there, where Matt is battling Blackheart, and he's battling Mephisto. He gets caught up with Atlantis attacks and Acts of Vengeance. I mean, just all kinds of great stuff. Silver Surfer's in there, too, and a giant battle with Ultron. I mean, this is great, great stuff. So again, Ann Nesenti wrote the majority of it. Most of the art's by John Romita Jr. and Al Williamson. It's absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous. It's full color. Normally goes for $49.99, but you can get it for 38% off right now. So it's only $27.89. And this thing is like, oh my gosh, I don't have the page count in front of me, but it's got to be like 15 issues. It's huge. It's massive. And oh my God, this is one of my probably absolute favorite runs of Daredevil. Now, sir, all the other cool kids who come to the party pick an in-stock trade selection. Did you happen to pick one?
I brought three.
Oh my gosh. All right.
I've got the Muhammad Ali hardcover, which is normally $19.99. Going for $11.59, you save a whopping 42%. The Muhammad Ali hardcover covers Muhammad Ali's life and career as a boxer, his time as Cassius Clay, growing up in his neighborhood, and just chronicles pretty much his whole life. Definitely in key because this has boxing. I'm also doing Blue and Gold, currently for $19.99. Going for $11.59, also saving 42% off. This one just tales what's going on with Ted and Booster in the current DC era. They try to get on the Justice League the only way they know how, by becoming YouTube influencers. Needless to say, shenanigans arise and nothing goes right.
That is an amazing collection. In fact, we had Dan Juergens, the writer of that, on the show to talk about it just a few months back.
It's so good. I love that episode. And it introduces Buggles.
Yes. Yes.
Which is one of my new favorite characters. I wonder if I can audition for Buggles.
You got the voice for it.
Works for me. And then finally, because it's me, I'm going to be also promoting Green Lantern Circle of Fire trade paperback new edition. This goes for $39.99 and retails now for $23.19. Again, 42% off. This is a new printing and expands from the Circle of Fire, which tells Kyle's story of fighting one of his mortal enemies. And the only reason it connects to JLI or JLE is because he has to team up with Power Girl, who I believe in this gets a new one of her newer, fancier suits.
Ah, well, I'm a fan of this one because it also includes Firestorm in an era where he wasn't getting published too often. So, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your help through our Patreon. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows, it requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, and we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI Podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FWPodcast. And while you're there, consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI Podcast. Our thanks go out to Chris Lewis, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zemkowski, Roger Preeb, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, Tim Price, and a special thanks to some goober named Joe Tanello.
Toss him.
Exactly right. And again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast. All right, so go out on the social media. We need you to be part of this conversation. This is an issue everybody remembers. We're going to be talking about Justice League America number 52, the boxing issue between Guy Gardner and Blue Beetle. Everyone remembers this one. Tons of folks have talked about it. By the way, Joe, you're a lucky man, because over the many, many years I've been doing this podcast, you requested this issue, oh my gosh, probably in the first year of the show. I think you got locked in, so that's what, 6 years ago or something. But either way, I've been asked by so many people if they could do this issue. I'm like, sorry, it's already promised to somebody. So you got in early, and you got, well done, sir.
Hooray, patience paid off.
So I need you folks to go to the social media, though, and talk about it. Tell us what you like. Talk about the fight of the century. Talk about Guy Gardner, Blue Beetle. Talk about Joe. It's easy. I do it all the time. So go out on the social media, use our hashtag FWPodcast, or tag us at JLI Podcast on Facebook and Twitter, because as I always say, it's all about building a community of online JLI fans around the show. All right, Joe, so I've been picking on you because we've been buddies a long time, but now it's time to get serious. I need you to tell me and the people at home your personal origin story with the JLI. How'd you fall in love with the book?
Well, my origin story is a long one told over many, many moons.
You know it's a short show, right, Joe?
Yes, but since we can't cover 23 years, the short version is I lived in Korea when I was little. So that's where my love of comics started, because my sister was an infant and a lot of the toys were model figures that you had to put together. So instead, we went to base and I kept getting comics. And from there, I started to narrow down who I liked. And the Len Wein Ted Blue Beetle was at the top of my list because he was kind of a funny, well-adjusted Batman, which he still is a funny, well-adjusted Batman. But as I got older, comics kind of drifted away to video games, you know, as you do. And then I started getting into cosplay. And then one of my first costumes after Ambush Bug was Blue Beetle.
Woohoo!
From there, I started collecting the trades, and I got really close to completing the collection that was out. But eventually the JLI trade starting getting about as roughly as expensive as the JLI omnibus piece. So kind of stopped getting that. I did get the fantastic DC showcase that compiles all of Ted's solo book by Len Wein.
Mm-hmm.
They've been really special to me. I have Ted as a cosplay now, Kyle Rayner, who's my favorite Green Lantern, Jack Knight, which Shag got to see in person.
I did.
In fact, I actually have my Cosmic Rod Mark II in the background in my room, which I can show Shag later. Not a euphemism.
Hey, Joe let me touch his rod, by the way. But you know,
yes, it was very shiny.
Take it for what that is.
I am powered by moonlight.
Oh my gosh.
Wally West, Ben Reilly. I love the 90s comics, but I love the characters that weren't the, well, pretty much every other 90 character where they had an infinite amount of pouches and a gun that would not be physically possible to handle. Plus, all these characters just moved their legacies forward is what I really enjoyed. It's people that take up the mantle, but move forward in their own way.
And I got to say, that parallels me as well. I mean, the characters you named there, Kyle Rayner, Jack Knight, Wally West, Ben Reilly, those are some of my, and of course, Ted Gord, those are some of my absolute all-time favorite characters. I'm looking at a Ben Reilly action figure that's on my desk right now. I've got a Kyle action figure right off to my right, and a Jack Knight action figure, and a Wally West one. I mean, these are all, and of course, Ted Gord, these are all characters I absolutely adore. The parallels are strong. In fact, without getting into the specifics, I will tell you, when Joe and I went out to dinner one night, we're talking, and out of the blue, he just mentions, hey, do you live somewhere around this area? And he mentions the middle school Joe went to. He's like, yeah, that's about the only thing I can remember. It was the exact same middle school my daughter was attending. I traveled halfway across the country to meet you, Joe, and you went to the same middle school as my daughter. That's insane. Absolutely crazy. Too many spooky parallels, Joe. Too many spooky parallels. I can't pull off the cosplay like you, though, Ken, though.
Sir. Oh, yeah, you can. Sure you can.
Yeah, I don't know how to sew.
Neither do I. See, I have the wonderful thing of I can design something, then I hand it off to all my friends because I have a lot of amazing friends as a result of the costuming. I'm part of multiple charity groups now. Cosplay Collective, Dad Bod Cosplays and Associates, Middle Tennessee API, which is Asian Pacific Islander Association, the Tennessee Ghostbusters. I'm a part of that. I have the black suit from the comic books. I have a one-to-one scale of an Extreme Ghostbuster Proton Pack directly to my right. I recently made and built my own version of a PKE.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, it's really neat. The kids love it.
I was going to ask you about that. So, folks, I want Joe to explain this, but you guys do some amazing stuff with kids in hospitals, right?
We do. During the holidays, mostly Christmas. So what we do with Cosplay Collective is throughout mid-November till the second to last week, right before Christmas, we have a toy drive all around Nashville. All the comic book stores take part of it. All the local toy shops take part of it. And then we have a GoFundMe. And then we go to a local Target. We buy as many toys as we can for a list the hospital provides us. And then our founder, she takes it to her place, wraps all the toys with her family members, with her wife. And then we go to the hospital and we go deliver the toys, or we go hand out candy during Halloween or Valentine's Day cards during Valentine's Day, because I lived in the hospital for the first 2 years of my life. I know what it's like to be a kid and not be there for a holiday, and being able to go do that for them has always been very special for me. During the pandemic, I was actually the hospital's loophole. So the child wing would go, hey, can you hop in your Spidey? Hey, can you hop in Ghostbuster? I actually did donate a full-size War Machine helmet that was like 3D printed, and I donated it to the oncology ward as a toy. One of the kids just up and took it home.
Smart kid.
It fit him. It wouldn't fit me.
Oh, gosh. The stuff you, I've seen lots of pictures you posted over the years, the stuff, and the, what you just described, it's amazing, Joe. I mean, that is so incredible and so heartwarming, and it combines so many wonderful things, you know, helping kids, superheroes, the joy, the charitable actions. It's just amazing. I'm blown away.
It's one of the great things I love doing. I just want to help and give back as much as I can.
Well, it's you guys certainly are to be commended, and you're some of the good folks out there. I got to tell you.
How's your Blue Lantern ring?
It is doing quite well. It's on my bookshelf. You gave me a 3D printed Blue Lantern ring, which I have in a place of honor. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So, you know, with all the teasing, it does hurt me physically to praise you as much as I have. So I'm going to have to put an end to that segment. I'm sorry, Joe. We're going to have to move on and talk about this amazing comic book. Is that okay with you?
I mean, I get one on the notch marker, but yeah, let's keep going.
All right, folks, so we are going to talk about Justice League America, number 52. Now, if you want to see some images from this, go out to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, and there'll be an image gallery. I'm not going to post a lot, though, folks. I mean, nowadays, these things are out there on DC Infinite. You can get on a Comixology. You can buy, you know, the collected editions. You can buy the floppy issues. I mean, this thing is very, very available. So go out and get yourself a copy of Justice League America, number 52, published by DC Comics, cover dated July 1991. It was on the shelves May 14th, 1991, and the cover price is $1 for shiny quarters. And the cover is by Adam Hughes and Joe Rubenstein. So, you want to tell us about the cover?
Yep, the cover is a mock-up of a vintage boxing poster with Guy Grinder Gardner, which is a horrible misnomer. Guy should be Guy Glassjaw Gardner. going against Blue Battling Beetle. We'll save the naming. I'm guessing Elrond did the naming on this poster.
Probably.
This seems to be more in Ted's favor on the poster, giving Guy's track record with punching or just blows to the head. The cover also promises 12 fantastic bouts. That is also in association with Max Lord Enterprises. Neither of them are true. Clearly, this is Elrond's work. I did notice, and I went through the trouble and I found it, this cover is loosely based on a very famous boxing poster. This is actually based off the Frazier versus Ali poster of circa 1971.
I'm so glad you said that, because I had no idea. I mean, I knew it looked like your traditional boxing poster, but after you pointed that out, I Googled it. Oh, wow. It really does. I mean, this cover is all yellow. I mean, just lots and lots and lots of yellow for miles as far as you can see, which is a pretty garish color to put on this on a cover, but it works. And once you look at the Frazier and Ali poster, it's like, oh, that's also a bright yellow with red letters just like this. So that one says the fight of the century. This one says the fight of the century. It is very nicely mocked up in that way. And even if you look at Frazier's pose and Ali's pose, they actually mimic them. I mean, Hughes was clearly looking at this poster when he drew the guys.
Yep, it's almost a one-for-one. Like, the only thing I would give it is I think we would get a much more entertaining match out of Frazier and Ali.
Yes, I would think so as well. A couple other things worth noting is they did change up the traditional JLA trade dress on the issue. Like, the Justice League of America logo is there, but they've gotten rid of the border. They've gotten rid of the stars. They skipped the corner box where they usually have, underneath the issue number, usually has a couple of characters. And here's the thing I thought was most clever, and I didn't catch this at first. It took a couple of viewings to notice it. The UPC box is kind of sort of missing. So it depends on whether you have the direct market version or the newsstand version. But either way, what they've done is instead of a traditional, you know, box, like a square bordered box with the UPC code that's white, they've gotten rid of the border, so there's no border. There's also no white. It's the UPC code is also yellow, just like the cover. And they didn't put it in the corner. They stuck it right in the middle at the bottom. So if you've got the newsstand edition, you've got the UPC code in between all the hype. But then the direct market version, they've just got the JLI logo, and it's right between the 12-round championship bout and Maxwell Lord. And it just looks seamless. Like, I didn't even realize it until I started wondering where that UPC box was. And I probably spent way more time talking about a UPC box than I should, but I found it fascinating.
Yep.
And that's the kind of feedback I get from my favorite kind of co-hosts. Thank you. All right, let's get into this. So inside, plot and breakdown is by Keith Giffen. Script is by J.M.D. Mateus. Penciler is Trevor Von Eden. There's a new name on the book. Inker is Randy Elliott. Letter is Bob LePan. Colorist is Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor is Kevin Dooley. And editor is Andy Helfer. And the issue itself is called, and this is great, it says, the battle of the century. But century struck through. Decade, that struck through. Year, that struck through. And then it says, month, with a question mark. So the battle of the month. Why don't you start us off, Joe?
The book opens up with the title mirroring the cover, proclaiming this to be the match of the century, only for it to be immediately reduced to month. Even then, it's only maybe. Ted's yelling in horror, only to pan out that Ted's screaming in terror is only due to him not being able to fit into his uniform anymore due to consistent weight gain. Personally, I blame the Oreos being left around the embassy. He quickly remembers when he was a younger child with weight problems, and all all the bullying he endured. Then, meanwhile, in another part of the embassy, John Jones comes into the, I want to say, kitchen? Breakfast nook?
Yeah, it's definitely a kitchen.
Okay, there we go. To see B with fire with a mug of coffee turning in for the day, having been out partying all last night. Elrond makes a brief appearance, and Kellogg is complaining about a new immigration policy that pertains just to aliens visiting Earth, and hands John his immigration application, much to John's dismay. Then we smash cut over to Guy Gardner doing push-ups with Donkey Kong, or Doc Samson with miscored hair. Possibly a new version of the Hulk trying to find peace in the DC universe. No, it's General Gorey, whose character model wildly shifts more than John ever will in any issue of JLI. Guy is still completely subservient to Glory and continues to push up nearly until passing out. Ted comes in wanting to join them, trying to be able to get back into beetle shape. Ted asks if he can join, and Glory happily accepts while Guy happily insults. Despite warnings from Glory, Guy goes too far messing with Ted as he's doing deadlifts, nearly killing Ted in the process, potentially. So naturally, a fight breaks out. John comes in and sees the commotion going on. Glory holds the two apart rather easily while suggesting to John why the two settle the dispute with a boxing match. Fire, hearing the news, goes straight to Ice, who's still waking up from trying to keep up with B and her escapades out last night. B excitedly tells Tora about Guy's match. Tora wonders, why did I even get out of bed at all? Well, then we jump around again in the embassy to see Batman entering the building, lamenting that while he can handle any villain in from the Arkham Asylum or any villain in Gotham at all, without even blinking so much as an eye, the very presence of the JLI embassy physically makes him unwell. Upon entering the building, Elrond spots the Caped Crusader and tells him of today's events. Bruce immediately proclaims this is why I never come out in daylight ever. Kellogg passes him still reading immigration papers, mentioned to Batman not to ask. Batman immediately agrees he won't. He rushes to the gym, greeting Batman, but rushes past him to see the fight, while Tora slowly follows B, telling Batman not to ask. Batman thankfully tells her he wasn't going to. The fight starts with the JLI gather out, naturally with Guy running his mouth, while Ted sits there in his corner, only saying that Guy should get ready.
All right, so I'll take it from here. So in the boxer ring, Guy's trying to act all macho, right? He's trash-talking Ted. Then Ted lashes out with a belt to Guy's face. Guy lands on his butt, totally shocked at Ted's lightning-fast punch. Guy gets back up, takes a few swings at Ted, but misses. Ted then compares Guy to the bullies that beat him up when he was a kid, until Ted learned to defend himself. Ted then lands another powerful punch right in Guy's face, giving Guy a bloody nose. At that moment, Elrond rings the bell, signifying the end of round one. Well, Guy Gardner's furious. Ted is really outshining him, and Guy insists that, quote, nobody bleeds Guy Gardner. Now, even though the fight is on hold between rounds, Guy rushes at Ted when his back is turned. Guy delivers a kidney punch to Ted, and then when Ted drops to the ground, Guy kicks Ted in the ribs. Now, this is beyond unsportsmanlike conduct. This is a brutal ambush. Now, with Ted curled up in agony, the JLI all scream at Guy for attacking Ted. Martian Manhunter is livid and declares Guy Gardner's Justice League membership is revoked. As Guy walks out of the ring, he reminds them that only Maxwell Lord can kick him out of the league. Ice then runs after Guy, trying to convince him to apologize, but Guy yells at Ice, saying he doesn't need to apologize, and he doesn't need her. Later, while recovering from his bruised ribs, Ted is visited by Martian Manhunter. Now, Ted tries to blame himself, saying that if he'd been in better shape, maybe this wouldn't have happened, but Martian Manhunter reiterates that Guy will be out of the league once Max returns for this behavior. Fire then barges into Guy's room, berating him for yelling at Ice. After Fire storms out, Guy sits alone in the dark as he realizes the weight and the consequences of his actions. Finally, Max arrives at the embassy with his latest lady love, a woman named Wanda. As they prepare to enter the embassy, Max drops to the sidewalk, bleeding. He's been shot! Next issue, the beginning of the end. Dun-dun-da! By the way, that means breakdowns. All right, buddy, so what'd you think of this issue?
This was a really odd issue.
Okay.
I really can't put it any other way. Like,
you've been waiting like 6 years to talk about it, and the first thing you can say is it's odd.
I do my best work. What can I tell you? It's just so, like, I read it like once a month to keep up for it. And it's just like, this is the start of the Fat Ted arc, which doesn't resolve until much later when he and I think Power Girl get him back into shape. But it's just like so many random things are happening at once. I mean, even for a JLI issue, like if this was a sitcom, this would be a very messy bottle issue because they don't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, we got like B coming in from party. We don't get to see any of that. We only lightly touch on the immigration stuff for the aliens, which John can take or leave it. The artwork is so bizarrely inconsistent with Major Gory. Like, one page, the reason I make Donkey Kong joke is the push-up phase, he legit looks like Donkey Kong.
Yeah, I'll say it. I mean, the art in this issue is not my favorite. I like Trevor Von Eden's artwork normally. I do. But this is not my favorite era of his work. I mean, it's perfectly serviceable. And there are some good pieces. But overall, it's not what we're used to in a JLA comic, you know?
Yeah. Like, his Kilowog. Well, Kilowog's sitting there reading the paper. That's outstanding. Like, that is an amazing Kilowog. But then his Major Glory, like, I want to keep saying Major Glory. It's General Glory.
Right.
Major Glory's the dude from Dexter's Lab.
A lot of the, like, Guy Gardner's kind of on model for the Joe Staten version.
Yes.
But the other character, I mean, Batman's mostly on model. But yeah, there's a lot that's kind of all over the board, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Like, just like two panels later, General Glory looks like a completely normal dude. And then you go to the next page and he's got like Chris Hemsworth piggy face.
Yeah, it's not good. Now, to be fair, we have only seen General Glory without his mask once or twice, so there isn't a lot of model work out there, but it could at least be consistent within the issue itself.
Right.
I do suspect that Von Eden did not use Giffen's layouts very closely, because, you know, normally Giffen draws the whole comic, you know, in layouts, but here there's no 9-panel grids. Most of the panel design, it is interesting, actually. There is some cool panel design, but it doesn't look like Giffen's work. There are a handful of diagonal panels that I think look really, really sharp. And there's good use of splash pages in a lot of this, but I think he was probably doing his own thing here, which is a testament to him as an artist and a storyteller. But yeah, it's definitely a different issue.
I wonder if that's what makes the comic feel so cluttered, is the layout is so wildly different, because we have like some of these panels are actually overlapping each other at some points. So it's not that it's hard to read, it's very easy to track, but it just feels cluttered. Like everybody's day feels more cluttered. Like everything's happening at once. You don't really follow a real beaten path. It's just like everybody's waking up, morning workout, midlife crisis, I got a gut, immigration, Batman wondering why he didn't find Duke earlier and make him the signal so he could do this. I mean, I want to say this has got to be a turning point for the JLI, because like, I don't think I've seen an issue, like I said, this cluttered before. Like normally it's good office fun, but this is just like really, really out there.
Well, it's interesting because it is a turning point in a lot of ways. Guy getting in trouble here has a lot of long-term ramifications. Everyone remembers the boxing issue. You know, everyone felt like, it's funny, everyone felt like this had been building for a long time, but really, I don't think the evidence is there. I mean, Guy's always been a jerk, but I don't know that there's been a big rivalry building between Guy and Beetle specifically that looked like it was going to turn violent. So I wouldn't say there's an organic growth there, but it makes sense in the context of this issue. But it is very much a bottle episode. You're right, because they know they've got a giant 15-part crossover coming literally next issue. And so this issue, they know it has to be self-contained. The way you described it as a bottle episode makes perfect sense. It's a great way to handle it. It's a day in the life. And there's some fun stuff. So there's a lot of wackiness in here. I do wonder about some of the plots. You know, like, some of them are thrown in there to remind us of subplots. For example, they talk about fires living on the wild side, right? But that's because Oberon is away. So it's reinforcing the potential for them as a couple, which becomes an issue, coming up pretty soon. I don't know what's going on with the Alien Registration Act stuff. I don't want to know. I'm looking forward to finding out. I don't know if this is just a throwaway for here in this issue and it's kind of funny, or if it's going to be an ongoing plot. I'm interested to find out. If it's just a throwaway for this issue, that's fine. But I feel like they're building something there.
And I think this also starts the turning point for Guy and Ice too, isn't it? Where it's one of those will they, won't they? And that right now it's most definitely they won't.
I specifically don't remember what happens in Breakdown. So I don't know where that's going to go, but this is a point where obviously, yeah, Guy and Ice with the will they won't they kind of situation. This is an important point in that, certainly. I want to point out one more thing about the art. And this is a compliment to Trevor Von Eden, which is the use of shading in this comic is really clever. Not just in a couple of certain pages, but if you look at the first part of the story, he just does normal shading. But the moment Guy goes over the line, right, with the illegal punch and the kicking and all that, the use of shading in this comic ramps up big time. Some of the borders are turned black. There's lots of shadows everywhere. I mean, Trevor Von Eden knows what he's doing. He makes the panels feel claustrophobic in certain ways. It's just really a clever technique, and I was very impressed with what he did there.
Yeah, the most noticeable one is where Guy is storming out of the gym. Like, he is completely covered in shadow and a little bit of yellow. So I'm wondering if that's foreshadowing his taking of the yellow power ring when he just becomes Guy Gardner.
Wow. I think that's a bit of a retcon considering how far away it is, but that's an interesting thing you could say. Yeah. I like specifically page 20, the one where Fire comes in there, screams at him, and Guy just sits there and takes it. I mean, he doesn't really fight back. He defends himself a little bit, but not much. He mainly just sits there and lets Fire scream at him. But then it's got these cool diagonal panels, and he's just sitting there in the dark. And he's like, damn. I mean, he knows that he's crossed the line. He knows he's messed up. And the thing about Guy, and I've been trying to point this out when I can, is Guy actually cares about the team. He loves these people. He doesn't know how to show it. And he knows his ego won't let him. But like, there was an issue where Oberon got stabbed. And instead of Guy being a jerk, he immediately went into helping Oberon mode. He was bossing people around, trying to save Oberon's life. Meanwhile, going out there to stop the crazed blue beetle who stabbed him. Guy really does love them. And so I think at this point, he knows he has messed up and he's alienated his family. And he knows he's screwed.
See, I wonder if that's why in the one of the panels for... I forget which, in 20, that long shadow that's casted over Guy is blue because it's going to be, it's Ted's shadow that's casting over him because he's guilty for attacking Ted.
Oh, wow. That could be. Yeah, that's interesting. That could very well be. Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, another thing should point out here about Guy that, okay, so what Guy does is he specifically, in between the rounds, he goes over, he's pissed off, he goes over, well, Ted's back is turned, the fight is not currently on, and Guy punches him, not just in the back, he punches him in the kidneys, which is an illegal boxing move. He punches him in the kidneys, Ted drops, and then Guy kicks him right in the ribs. So, first of all, it's horrible. It's not, it goes, as I said, well beyond the unsportsmanlike conduct. It's way over the line. But then I remembered Guy was a physical education. He's a PE coach. That was his job. So he knows the rules of boxing. He knows exactly what he's doing. So this isn't just losing his temper. He made an active choice to screw the rules and take it out on Ted. And that's just, wow, that's shocking.
See, the thing I have, and I love Guy. Guy is my second favorite. Well, he's moved down the list by one. He's my third favorite Green Lantern. Behind Kyle and newly introduced Lantern, Jessica Cruz. I wonder if this is one of those personalities Guy has to deal with because of all the head trauma. And I don't mean that as a joke. Like, you can literally see, we've seen Guy have different personalities based on his head trauma before.
Yeah.
We've seen Standard Guy. We've seen Super Chill Guy. We've seen Happy Guy. We've seen Super Subservient Guy. I'm wondering if this is just one of those just personalities or repressed rage moments that just overwhelm him from the hit to the face. And it's just one of those sees red and is clearly not thinking scenarios.
That would make a lot of sense. That would track. I mean, because he's definitely not in his right mind. Once he gets, like you said, seeing red, once he gets the bloody nose, he is unhinged.
He's on.
Yeah, he's unhinged completely and he's ready for anything.
And then the moment we see him in the room after he tells Tori to get out, and then when B comes in, he's just like, yeah, I screwed up. It's like, this should, I did, that happened, but I shouldn't have done it. So that's one of those Guy rage moments that are people really think is normal for Guy, but if you read the book long enough or you read stuff like JLA or GL Core, that's not usual for Guy.
Right. Or even Guy's own book. I mean, you know, he's a much deeper character. He has a whole lot of bravado. He's the jerk we all know. Everyone knows a jerk like this. But really, this particular individual, Guy Gardner, is not a bad dude. He's just got a lot of stuff going against him, and he makes a lot of bad choices or gives into a lot of bad impulses. Maybe is a better way to say it.
I mean, my favorite moment with Guy in all books is easily during Blackest Night, where he thinks Kyle's dead, and his rage for his best friend dying summons a red lantern ring to him.
Mm.
And then we get the dual wielding, jokingly called Christmas Lantern. But it's that's how angry Guy is he can generate enough rage and enough will to dual wield two rings.
If you guys listening have only really experienced Guy through the lens of JLA or JLI, I strongly recommend you seek out other stuff. Seek out the Guy Gardner series, specifically the later stuff written by Bo Smith. Seek out the GL Core stuff that you just referenced with Pete Tomasi stuff. I mean, Guy is a fantastic character. He really is. And there's a lot more to him than you may realize. So,
yeah.
So a couple other quick things. It was nice to see Batman in the issue, but quite frankly, I forgot he was still on the team. So when he first showed up, I'm like, what's he? Oh, is he just visiting? Oh, he's still part of the team?
I didn't even realize he was part of the team either.
I thought he'd quit. I don't know. You lose track after a while. A lot of characters come in and out. And they do tell us, by the way, with the upcoming Breakdown storyline, there will be roster changes. So I haven't read Breakdown since it was published. What is that, 30 years ago? So I'm looking forward to re-experiencing this and finding out. Because again, I don't remember when it happens. Obviously, Guy's on the team after that. So I know he's not out forever. But I am very interested to see how it plays out. And I'm very interested to see if my memory of it matches what I'm reading now. Like for example, the General Glory Saga had a bit of a bad reputation. And reading those issues, you guys heard me every episode, those were some fun comics. So I'm looking forward to see how Breakdowns plays out. And, you know, maybe it's better than we all remember.
You know, I after reading this and reading some of the stuff, is it just me or does General Glory feel like he comes from the Tick?
He definitely feels like he comes from the Tick. I hadn't heard it verbalized quite like that, but yeah, who played the Tick first? Warburton? What's that guy's name?
Patrick Warburton, who is also Kronk, who I just imagine that's what General Glory just sounds like, is Patrick Warburton.
Exactly. He'd be perfect for that character. Oh my gosh, yeah. All right, so we got to address one thing here, and it's a bit delicate, folks, so forgive me, but especially from a modern perspective, but we got to talk about it. So in this issue, Ted Kord is overweight, and there's a lot of humor surrounding that. So what I got to ask of both of us here, you know, are the writers just finding some humor in the fact that Ted has put on some extra pounds? Or are they fat shaming him? You know, clearly Guy Gardner as a character is doing that. Guy is fat shaming without a doubt. But the question is the comic itself fat shaming him? And also, please be aware that, you know, 1991 was a different time. The fat shaming term is a much more recent thought process, and things were treated very differently in 1991. I'm not defending that. I'm just saying it was. So you can go first. You can make me go first. You know, what you got any thoughts on this?
I really don't think they're fat shaming him. I kind of see this as them moving Ted out of the light for a little bit and giving him a character arc so that they have something for Ted to do and a goal for Ted to accomplish later on down the road. Because over the course from this book forward, we don't really see him get fatter, but we do see him putting forth effort to try and lose the weight. Now, weight loss is a give and take. JLI, it's an ongoing, it's serialized. So you have an overarching story, and this is Ted's newest story for him, is literally the Battle of the Bulge.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but that makes a lot of sense, especially now that they've taken Booster Gold out of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, Booster Gold's off doing his own thing, so what does that leave Ted to do? And you're right, here is a B plot or even a C plot for Ted to have in the issues, and it makes a lot of sense. I had not thought about that. I'll add that I agree with you. I don't think they're fat shaming him, because in fact, he recognizes he's got a weight issue. He wants to do something about it. The only person picking on him is Guy. And then, not only that, we see Ted kick his butt in the ring. So they're saying, even though he's put on some pounds, he's still a great fighter. He's still top of his game. And so I think that I don't think the issue is mocking the weight gain. I think it's just bringing out, demonstrating how jerks treat people that way.
The other thing they did, and this is like a retcon for like way down the road that they did, was this was a point of depression in Ted's life.
Mm-hmm.
That he says, like, hey, I gained weight. I was constantly choosing monitor duty. I was constantly hanging back, and it was a sign of depression because we keep forgetting at this point in time, Ted joined the JLI because this picks up from his book. He lost Court Industries at the end of his personal book, and he was dealing with the depression of losing his company. On top of that, now the booster's gone. He's lost his best friend. He's lost Mr. Miracle, which was also one of his best friends.
Oh, yeah.
He keeps losing people in his life. We don't know where, is it Trixie? Is that his assistant?
That was actually Booster's assistant.
Booster's. Who was
I can't
it
remember.
Diane?
I can't remember. There was somebody, yeah, in his
I want to say Diane, but I might be wrong.
So that's a good point. He doesn't have a life outside the JLI. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't have a life outside the JLI. And if you look at his life, he has a continuous string of loss. And that form of depression can just manifest itself in just being lethargic and eating for comfort, in which case this is the end result of it. But we see him slowly trying to pull himself not only out of the depression, but to get himself back into shape as the book progresses forward. Now, of course, the death of Superman doesn't help in any of that, but...
Right. Yeah. I mean, that changes the direction of everything. And if I recall, I think Beetle's pretty much back to fighting shape at that point, I want to say. But I don't recall exactly. But I will point out that this isn't a plot line that came out of the blue. Because if you go back to the Despero issues, or Despero, or whatever you want to say, those issues, there is a moment in there where Ted is running and he's like way out of breath and he mentions how he's gotten out of shape. So they were laying the seeds of that. And that was a good, 10 issues ago, probably by now. So they were laying the seeds a while ago for this plot line.
Yeah. And like, they also retconned Ted to have a heart issue in current books.
Yep.
So, I mean, that also can contribute to, I mean, the heart issue could also can contribute to the weight gain as well. I mean, there's just a litany but reasons, but I personally don't think this was a fat joke for the sake of fat joke. I think this is, as I stated earlier, this is Ted's new character arc.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. The only other major thing I want to talk about the issue is the very end. You know, Max shows up at the embassy with Wanda, this young lady who is his lady love. He's clearly very enamored with her. Wants to introduce her to the family, as he calls it. And interestingly enough, and I want to say Tim Price pointed this out to me back when we did it, but issue 41 of this book, Max used his mental powers on a girl to get him to go back to his apartment with him. And it was a girl named Wanda. And I'm wondering if it's the same girl. Now, she was a redhead. This one has black hair. That's easily fixed with hair dye and wigs or whatever. So, but I'm going to, you know, decide in my mind it's the same girl. And hopefully he's trying to make himself an honest man and not using his mental powers on her. But the big moment, of course, is Max gets shot. And I kept thinking about it, like, where have I seen this before? Max got shot back in issue number 9. His secretary, who was a manhunter, shot him a whole bunch of times. And the computer had, like, his evil computer patched him up temporarily. But Max ends up in the hospital for a long time, life and death kind of, for being shot. And here we go. Once again, Max gets shot. He might want to invest in some kind of armor, I'm thinking.
Yeah, well, the Wanda thing, I wonder if she was changed from a redhead to black hair solely for the fact that I think Wanda in Marvel during 91 was a redhead.
Oh, okay. Well, so yeah.
That may be the reason for differentiation, but like that's really reaching and I'm 5'5", so I can't reach very far.
It could also be that it's a comic that's, a year old and who really cares what this girl's hair color was.
That is also a thing.
Yeah.
Max being shot. Yeah. The last time Max was shot, he got a JLI communicator. So
yes, he did.
I wonder what he's going to get from being shot this time.
Yeah. Well, we're going to find out because that's a big piece of breakdowns, I remember. And some of the upcoming annuals, too.
Yep.
So yeah, I had a random thought the other day. This goes out to all of you fans of Battlestar Galactica, right? Not the original series, but the reboot series from the 2000s. You know, I'm one of those fans myself. And a lot of us are known for not liking BSG after the episode everyone refers to as the boxing episode. They say like, oh, the show took a turn. It's not as good after the boxing episode. Well, here we are with the JLI comic. And it's the boxing episode, essentially. And the next issue begins Breakdowns, which a lot of people have some very strong feelings about Breakdowns. So maybe there's a thing with boxing issues being a jumping the shark moment that no one ever realized till now.
I mean, quite possibly. I haven't seen Battlestar Galactica, but most definitely this does start changing not only the landscape, but the mood of the book for to a degree. We haven't quite hit the extreme 90s where we have like hyper stylized mega armor and we're going to be having hyper cable blasters out of construct rings quite yet. But we are slowly moving towards the extreme era of comic books.
We're going to have all the pouches.
Doesn't Tora get like some like super Viking outfit soon?
She definitely gets, now it's after this era, it gets into the one of the later, she's got kind of a sexy, very plunging neckline kind of outfit. But to be fair, when she came on board with the team, she had a pretty revealing outfit too.
She did. I mean, V's always got a costume. So, you know, now there's that one issue. Wait, does she have the form? This is the era where her whole form, where she's basically just Johnny Storm, right?
Yeah.
She's Green Johnny Storm now. But yeah, no, like I said, we aren't quite at the extreme era, but we're slowly making that shift over there. Like JLI, I feel, was like one of the last books to fully grip extreme, which is why we got moved into Extreme Justice in the other books. But that's a while from now, but we're starting to make that inevitable march.
Well, thank goodness this podcast ends at the end of the Giffen DeMatteis era, so I don't have to cover the extreme stuff. So before we get to the big awards, any final thoughts on the issue, maybe overall thoughts?
It's a big, clunky issue with a lot of moving parts. It's a really awkward bottle episode. Some really interesting choices in art. And that's saying somebody who's trying to read the John Romita Jr. Spider-Man. I'm in the do not like Lego Man drawings of John Romita Jr.
Oh, my gosh. I will say that I enjoyed the issue quite a bit. There's a lot I liked about it. I see what you're saying about there's a lot of stuff thrown at the wall here. It could be overwhelming, or you could just see it as a sitcom with everyone's got a thread, you know, everyone's got a moment sort of thing. The art, you know, we've said some tough things about the art. I want to step back from it, though, and say, guys, the art's, it's fine. It's not terrible if you look at it from the lens of a regular comic book in 1991. It's not awful. No. It's just not Kevin Maguire. It's not Adam Hughes. It's not Ty Templeton. It's not what we've gotten from this book. And this book is known for having top shelf art. And this, unfortunately, isn't that.
The biggest problem with the art, everything is fantastic until we get close-ups of faces. That's where it fumbles. Like, John's close-up in his face looks weird. We've already gone through the fact that this is nightmare fuel for General Goring yelling, "Guy, no." I mean, that's just terrifying, a terrifying piece of art. And then just inconsistent models for General Goring thing. But, like, if it's far away, it's fantastic. The shading is second to none. This man knows his shading.
Yeah.
The Kilowog is an amazing version of a Dower Kilowog.
He looks great. I love the extra folds, the extra wrinkles, like in his, you know, warthog face. It looks great.
Mm-hmm.
All right, folks, well, check out the issue yourself. Let us know your thoughts in the comments. But right now, Joe and I have to duke it out ourselves one-on-one for the
Plahaha Award.
This is where we nominate the funniest moment of the issue. Both myself and Joe will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Bwahaha Award. Joe, you're the guest, which has been unfortunate for all of us, but you get to pick first, sir.
I will go with Batman lamenting the fact that he, being even in proximity, makes him physically unwell. Because, I mean, it's Batman. You don't hear him complain too much, so this just makes me laugh that Batman goes like, "I can handle anything thrown at me, but being near this building, ugh."
That was a good bit. It was a good bit. I almost nominated something else on that same page, which was related, when Elrond refers to Batman as, "Oh, dark and dangerous dude." I really liked that bit. I thought that was pretty funny. But the moment I picked was on the next page, and it's continuing that whole arc with Kilowog and the alien immigration forms. And Kilowog is reading the form, grumbling to himself as Batman's listening in. You know, he's talking about, "Have you ever been part of an alien invasion force? What kind of question is that? You know, what color is your skin?" And then the part when he gets to, "Have you ever eaten a human being?" And he's like, "That does it. I'm taking this form and sticking it right up their noses. Have I ever eaten a human being? What do they think I am? Do they have any idea how awful human beings taste?" That part genuinely made me laugh. So that's what I give my nomination to, is Kilowog referring to how awful human beings taste. And of course, he's never eaten one. So now we have to go mano a mano. And if I have to, I will kidney punch you to get my way.
That's okay. I've been doing boxing to get back into shape myself. So you go for the kidneys, I'll go for the liver. We'll see who wins.
So what are we going to do? Flip a coin here? Flip a back coin?
No, actually, I'll give it to you because Batman complaining is funny, but the fact that, like, Kilowog, despite saying, have I ever eaten a human, and being saying he never has, he somehow knows they taste awful.
That's the funny part. That's what I like about it. All right. So thank you for rolling over and being a good guest and letting me win because it helps my ego. So congratulations to Kilowog. You have won the coveted Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. Now, Joe, I need to ask a favor.
Yes.
Would you mind keeping an eye on Guy as he packs up his stuff and gets ready to move out of the embassy? Because I'm a little worried they might have like a creative memory or perhaps sticky fingers for objects around the embassy that he thinks belongs to him versus what everyone else thinks belongs to who.
I still got to find Ted and see how long this hyperhelium is going to last.
Fair enough. Well, good luck fighting Ted. And don't worry, Joe, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, I'm going to head over to the London embassy for the 28th issue of Justice League Europe.
Do you like comics? The 1960s? How about middle-aged gay couples gossiping about their neighbors? Then you'll love Checkered Past.
A loving examination of DC's Go-Go Check branded comic magazines published from February 1966 to August 1967.
I'm Dr. Bob.
And I'm Dr. Husband.
And each week we'll be your hosts on a trippy tour through mid-century four-color madness. Checkered Past. Available wherever fine podcasts are downloaded for free.
Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Slide up to the bar alongside Ryan Daly and a rotating cast of guest hosts as they celebrate the long-running, award-winning television series, one hilarious episode at a time. New episodes of Cheerscast drop every Thursday, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
And now, our coverage of Justice League Europe, number 28. Back from break, and I'm here with my second co-host for this episode. This international guest comes all the way from the Pacific coast of Canada, and he is another longtime listener, first-time caller. In fact, this is his very first podcast appearance ever. Yes, first appearances are always a big deal. You might even say they're collectible. In fact, I'm planning for this podcast episode to have a foil-enhanced cover, so be sure to buy yourself two copies. Now, beyond being a newbie to podcasting, this guest also has some pretty impressive geek credentials. He's a special effects supervisor and has worked on things like Marvel Knights motion comics, Lego Star Wars Holiday Special on Disney+, My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, and Spidey and His Amazing Friends now on Disney Junior. How freaking cool is that? Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Mike Dynas. Welcome to the London Embassy, Mike. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Wait, London Embassy? I thought we were going to talk about Justice League Canada.
Sure, Mike. If you want to do that, yeah, we could talk about Justice League Canada. Maybe Flying Fox could be a member, or is this the one with Adam Strange and Justice League United? You tell me.
No, I was reading the issue. Like, don't they talk French like every so often?
That happens in some of the issues. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they display a lot of passive aggressiveness too, right, to each other.
Yeah, Catherine definitely does some of that. Yeah,
and they're all talking about free healthcare. This has got to be Canada.
I don't know if you've noticed or not, but some of those same things apply for Europe, such as in Justice League Europe. I'm not sure. Even if you notice in the issue, they talk about London a lot.
Yeah. You know what? I'll still be on, but I may have to make up a lot of stuff as we go on here.
Quick, edit your notes.
Yeah. Hang on.
Take all the references out of Tim Hortons. Those are not going to help you.
And Michael Bublé.
Exactly. Well, those are always good, though. So
yeah, but thanks for having me on.
I am so excited, Mike. You have been writing in the comment section for, I think, 18 years now. And it's finally about time we got you on a show.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad it's this one and not one I don't have any knowledge about.
Well, at least you're here as what I expect to be a wonderful guest to counterbalance the awfulness that we get out of Canada from Siskoid and Boss. So that'll be hopefully work out.
Yeah, it's real West Coast, East Coast thing. You'll notice I'm a lot more laid back.
I love that. Oh, that's fantastic. So I got to ask you, Mike. So, you know, you're here to talk about Justice League Europe and Justice League International, things like that. So how did you find the books? How did you fall in love with them?
Oh, man. You said that I've been typing in for a while. The story of me being with Justice League International goes back a while. So you might want to just get comfortable, sit in your beanbag real nice, just take a listen here. back when I was a kid, my parents usually, you know, during summer vacation, they would usually choose somewhere for us to go. My mom usually wanted to go somewhere exotic, like Europe, surprisingly enough, or, you know, just somewhere that usually would cost a lot of money. My dad loved camping. You know, the more remote in our little province of BC here on the West Coast of Canada, the better. He loved camping, he loved canoeing, he loved all that stuff. And so because that was usually the cheaper option, that's usually what we did. Well, one summer in 1987, and the reason I know that is because of this book, is that as we were camping and going from campground to campground and finding like little grocery stores along the way, on the spinner rack, I found two comics that changed the way I look at comics. One of them was Amazing Spider-Man number 294, which was part two of Kraven's Last Hunt. I'm not sure if you've heard of that one or not.
Maybe the guy who wrote it, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. And then surprisingly, I think he also wrote another one that same summer that came out called Justice League International number 7.
Never heard of that one.
Yeah, I don't know that one either. But the reason I picked that one up is because it had a little Canadian flag on it because it was international. Team looking, it had all those flags in the back, had the Canada flag. Like a lot of artists, they don't know how to draw the maple leaf, so it looks a little weird and wonky.
Being a fan of Alpha Flight, I have noticed the flag is more challenging to draw than you would expect.
Yeah, on those suits, it's just sometimes just atrocious. But yeah, and so I read these two comics, and they just, like, I'd been reading comics before then. I'm sure my mom had bought me so many comics and Digest. Shout out Digestcast.
Woo, woo.
But, you know, I'd read them, be like, yeah, that was fun, and toss them on the floor or whatever. During that summer, I read these two. I'm like, oh my God. Amazing Spider-Man, this can talk about like a serious issue of Kraven going through essentially a, you know, he's staring mortality right in the eye and he's dealing with his legacy. Seemed very adult to me, talking about these adult problems. Mm-hmm. And then on the complete opposite side of the spectrum was Justice League International. It's like, wait, superheroes can be funny too? They can make jokes and do dumb things and make me laugh out loud. And I saw those two. I'm like, wow, I didn't know comics could be like this. And I just have been collecting ever since.
1987, my favorite year in comic book publishing. So that's awesome. You found some great ones and it's the perfect year to discover it.
Yeah.
And Rob Kelly's got his mountain comics, so it sounds like you've got your camping comics.
Yeah, I definitely have camping comics, and those were definitely two of them. I think I also picked up like Gru number 32 or 33 that came out that summer. So that, like, we're talking, I don't know, we only camped, I would say, for like 3 weeks or something. But of course, with spinner rack distribution the way it was, you know, who knows what you're getting, anything from April, May, June, all the way to August or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. So
I picked that up and I'm like, oh my goodness, this isn't even a superhero. And it's just dumb and silly. But I laughed out loud with that too. And yeah, it was amazing that it just opened my eyes to what could be. And then as we got back, I noticed like, hey, wait a minute. There's a store in my town that is all it does is sell comics. Let's go there. Oh my goodness. This Justice League book comes out every month. Oh man, I got to start buying this every month. And yeah. And so I found that. I found like Who's Who, which is basically how I found you guys. I'm like, what? This is weird. This isn't even a story. It's got all these crazy costume characters and all this history, but I've never seen some of these guys before. This is amazing. I want to collect these comics now. I saw Akira. I'm like, what the bleep is this? You know, like, this isn't anything like any superhero book I've ever read. And then, like, even like smaller publishers like Comico and Eclipse and Now Comics with Ralph Snart. And like, oh man, it's more than just two companies that are making these things. Yeah, it really blew my mind at that year. And like I said, I never looked back, just kept collecting them.
That's awesome. So now, with that story about you reading Just League International, Just League America, and your insistence that we're going to cover Just League Canada, I got to ask, did you read Justice League Europe at any point?
No, not really. I don't even know why I'm on this show.
Oh, perfect. Okay, great. Excellent. That, you know, maintaining the quality of the program as it has for 6 years now. So that's perfect.
Yeah, no, just kidding. Of course, I did collect some Europe, but it was definitely that case of I'd pick it up and be like, well, it's not as funny as International or what would become known as America. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some storylines were kind of fun. So the Extremist storyline was great. I'm like, well, it's not funny, but man, this is really interesting in the way they're dealing with it. And like a dum-dum, I had no idea that these were analogs for Marvel supervillains.
Right.
Just like, oh, this guy looks cool with tentacles coming out of his head. I wonder how that would work and all this stuff.
I didn't know it till I started doing this podcast, so don't feel bad.
All right.
And, you know, that was always the intention with Just League Europe, too, is it was always supposed to be the more adventurous of the strips. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, they were on target. Well, let's get into this one. So we're here to cover Justice League Canada, number 28, published by DC Comics.
Do you want me to start singing the national anthem now, or how does this work?
I just want you to end every sentence with the word A.
Oh, no problem, eh? New dude to boot it.
So Justice League Europe number 28, published by DC Comics, cover dated July 1991, on the shelves June 4th, 1991, cover price $1 for shiny quarters, and the art is by Bart Sears. You want to describe
it,
Mike?
I think you mean $1.25, five shiny quarters.
Or UK 50p, I see as well.
That's true, too.
Yep. All of those are options depending on your currency system, sir. Yeah. You want to describe it for us?
Sure. Okay. Well, this is a really neat one. It's like about 8.5 by 11. It's on glossy paper. It's saddle stitch, staple bound. It's got the outer covering is really glossy, but like there's about, I would say about 32 newsprint pages in there. It smells like four color separated water-based.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah?
I think I get what you're doing there, but when I said describe the cover, I didn't actually mean the physical material. Maybe the artwork that's on the page could be something we could talk about.
I knew that.
I mean, if you collect comics just for the paper, you could have been buying Star Comics and saving yourself some money. I'm just saying.
That and Harvey Comics, too.
There you go.
Okay, well, if you want to talk about what's on the cover, we can do that. So, yeah, I would say it's just a beautiful cover. The color really pops. It's sort of like I would say in a bid to out Evanescence, Martian Manhunter with a starfish attached to his face is looking towards the heavens in joy as a few Justice League Europeans are laid discarded around him. What can only be described as a disgusting fever dream of Jacques Cousteau, covered by hundreds of mini sorrows. In the bottom right, the title is called Lost in the Stars, which gives you even more of a hint that Starro just might be in this issue.
I suppose it's possible. It just might be. So some of the trade dress stuff I always love, you've got the corner box with the character. So you've got Elongated Man and Rocket Red, which, you know, are not part of the cover design, but they're just the corner box. And I love that because Elongated Man's wrapped around Rocket Red. I always adore that one.
And he's got his little nose wiggling away, too.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. But now, getting into the cover itself, though, what Bart Sears has created here, I mean, it's a very, very busy cover. I mean, the amount of lines on this page is insane.
I don't even know how he would have, like, it must have taken him forever to draw these.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So Bart Sears, as we mentioned, has drawn this cover with literally hundreds of starfish all stacked on top of each other. And what you can't see is they're probably a foot deep. So there's probably another several hundred beneath this layer as well, right? I mean, it's disgusting. I mean, the smell has got to be absolutely horrible of all these starfish, you know, whatever. But I thought about this quite a bit. I mean, staring at this and I'm looking at all the fish. I'm like, okay, am I starting to, you know, do any of these fish repeat? You know, because typically when you get an artist who draws the same image over and over and over in a place like this, especially with the volume that he had to do here, you know, I figured he probably drew a couple of starfish and just photostatted the rest, you know, otherwise he'd go mad. So because we had Bart Sears on the show recently, I figured, all right, you know, I'll give it a shot. I'll reach out to him and ask. And I asked Bart, I said, did you, you know, draw each starfish by hand or did you photocopy them? And he wrote back right away and he said he drew every single starfish by hand. And he says he regrets it to this very day. And I mean, just, it is mind blowing.
Yeah. Well, and you can see the two, like the ones by Rocket Red, their little arms are curved a little bit to go against his body armor. You know, the ones going over Captain Adam's arm, they're kind of wrapped around his arms a little bit, you know, and Metamorpho's buried underneath. All you see is essentially his knees and a hand coming out. So yeah, it's amazing how much they went around.
I mean, the detail, I mean, think about that. Now he inked it himself too. So he didn't punish an inker, but he did punish the colorist. Because if you look, you know, Starro has this sort of fringe for the tentacles around the edges, or I don't know, phalanges around the edges, I guess. And so the colorist had to not just color the starfish, he had to color all the orange around the edges too, which is so thin. I mean, I just can't imagine how difficult this was for Bart and the colorist.
Yeah. Oh, but, man. And like you said, like, if it wasn't for that orange, you could have just done a huge purple swath to color most of it.
Well, and the color's what makes it work. So here's the clever thing. The cover is super, super, from the line work, super, super busy, like insanely busy. But the colorist has done an amazing job here of coloring all the starfish in this muted purple color. Now, they have the blue and the red and the orange like Starro has, but the majority of it's still this muted purple. So it is sort of a blandish background color, which then makes Martian Manhunter pop. It makes Rocket Red pop, and it makes the knee and hand of Metamorpho pop. So it's interesting that those colors still work with this cover, even no matter how busy it is.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the reasons. I mean, I joked before about not collecting it, but that's probably the reason that I picked this one up. It's just from a little bit farther away, it looks very stark. Like you basically gravitate to Martian Manhunter, and he looks just crazy. Like he's scary.
Mm-hmm.
He's almost scary the way that he's smiling and he's got the starfish on his head. But then as you get closer and you start looking around, you're like, oh my goodness, these are all starfish, right? It's amazing.
Again, I can just like hear the squelching in, like when you see the picture, I can hear the squelching of the starfish and it's grossing me out.
Yeah, how they had to get them to pose like that. You have to walk in like galoshes and then take the galoshes off to view the picture.
There's a reason all these guys wear armor. So,
and I love Bart Sears. He signed it too, but not like his traditional Bart Sears artwork. It's very small, and it's on one of the little starfish's arms in the sort of top right corner by Martian Manhunter's hand. And it almost looks at like the starfish has got a tattoo of Bart Sears' autograph.
That's fantastic. I didn't even notice the signature until right before we started recording. But yeah, I like the idea that it's a tattoo. That's perfect. See, Gustaro, he's getting the tats. I mean, that's just that's what he's up for.
You know it.
All right, let's get on the inside. So the credits are all listed in kind of a funny way. So it says plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen, script and script by Gerard Jones, pencils and pencils by Bart Sears, inks and inks by Randy Elliott, letters and borders by Bob LePan, colors and colors by Gene D'Angelo, this and that by Kevin Dooley, and stuff and nonsense by Andy Helfer. The issue itself is called The Man Who Wears the Star. You want to start us off?
Yeah, definitely. All right, so we start off with a star-o'd John Jones smashing through the ground to exclaim how much he enjoys being John Jones and having this sweet, sweet power. And Starro is going to work using that sweet, sweet power to take out the final members of the JLE who have not done the Starro. Captain Adam, Rocket Red, and Metamorpho, knowing that this is John Starro's in the Central Intelligence, know that they have to save their friend, but don't know how to do that without killing him. Gestaro decides to peace out to leave the other JL Starro members to take out the three amigos. After taking a beating, the three heroes decide to run, knowing they can't fight their friends. Back at the embassy, Kilowaro decides that he could spread his influence through the teleportation tubes, not worrying if he loses the body in trying. As he arrives in New York to the shock of Beetle and Guy, Kilowog looks a little disoriented as the Starro child has slid to the ground, sizzling away. This gives Kilowog an idea on how to beat the villain, but it also makes Euro-Starro wonder how he lost his vessel. Thanks to some closed captioning on the teleportation tubes, Starro might have figured out what happened. Back in New York, Kilowog's book learning gives him the idea that Ice's cold power might kill off Starro. But how to get Ice close to Starro for her to let it go? She can't hold it back anymore?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I've got kids. Come on. Back in Europe, Green Starro, who is monologuing that he doesn't need any regular transport now that he has the tubes, or so he thinks, watches trucks of fresh farm-to-table baby Starros coming out of the seafood plant. But wait, have the JL ears escaped?
Well, I'll take it from here. I can't compete with all the Starro jokes, but I'll do what I can here. So Captain Atom, Rocket Red, and Metamorpho return to the London Embassy, hoping to reach the teleport tubes. They storm their way in, fighting their own Starro-controlled teammates. However, Star Sue and Catherine Aro announce that they will kill the controlled leaguers if our heroes do not submit to the Starfish on the Face gang.
Oh, great band.
I have all their albums. Captain Atom and Rocket Red submit, but when Starro learns Metamorpho can't be controlled, they plan to straight up kill the Element Man. Luckily, at that moment, Blue Beetle pops out of the teleporter, grabs Metamorpho, and together they teleport safely back to New York. From the Big Apple, the JLA members watch the monitors, observing live footage from inside the London Embassy. The Martian Manhunter Starro threatens to start killing the citizens of London if the JLA members do not surrender and teleport to London one by one and submit to the Starfish of the Month Club.
Oh, that's great. It's like 1 cent for the first Starro, but it's like $13.98 from then on for like 6 months.
It's the Columbia Starro Club. That's exactly right. Yeah. So on cue, the teleporter restarts and Ice appears. She immediately freezes the Starro Prime on Martian Manhunter's face and the threat is over. Just like that. Boom, it's done. The good guys have won. Later, Captain Atom meets with Lord Manga Khan and gives him the frozen Prime Starro in exchange for a favor to be collected someday down the line. While the JLA members rest and recover from their ordeal, work is never done for Catherine Cobert. And she receives a call from Martian Manhunter saying, Maxwell Lord has been shot! Dun-dun-dun! Tie in to the issue we just covered, by the way. So it says, continued in JLA number 53, the start of a serious as heck 15-part Justice League crossover. Membership changes, villains, slugfests, call a doctor, and get ready for breakdowns. Oh boy.
No.
It's coming. It's a coming. So I got to ask you, buddy, what do you think of the issue?
It's real fun. Like, I think what really helps is having read the two previous issues where it sets up Starro like, oh, I'm not really a bad guy. And then like, no, I'm a bad guy and I'm about to take over the world. So this one, which is sort of like the ending, the climax of it, was fun. But having said that, it didn't really give a whole lot for much of the team members to do, especially the Europe members. Yeah, it just felt like they were trying to get to like a very specific place, especially with Kilowog, to get him to show how, like, he's learned this knowledge of, oh, I can just beat Starro with some ice. Hey, Ice, get in the teleport tube and bam, we're done.
Yeah, you know, last issue, they brought in Martian Manhunter to sort of save the day, even though he turned as a villain. But either way, it's like halfway through that issue, it suddenly became the Martian Manhunter show. You know, he was the one doing everything. And now this issue, the day is saved by Ice, which is all fine from a Justice League, you know, macro level. But just like you said, not the Europe members. I mean, this is their book. And here the Justice League America folks are kind of saving their bacon. So, yeah, that it doesn't sit poorly, but it's hard not to notice it.
Yeah, and it was even the Europe members who are in the book, they're almost treated like henchmen to a certain extent, right? Like they start fighting Captain Atom and Rocket Red and Metamorpho, but you don't really care that it's Power Girl or Blue Jay or whatever. It's just these guys are fighting and I didn't feel like, even though Captain Atom was having this big dilemma of like, oh, I can't punch my friends, can I? No, I can't. Even then, it just didn't feel as big of a dilemma as maybe it should have.
Yeah, I think it's because we saw them fight now last issue as well. So it felt like it was a little more of the same. I did want to talk about Captain Atom specifically. So you said like his indecision. And I'm trying to decide, because in this issue, he like freezes. Like he doesn't know what to do because he doesn't want to hurt his friends. So they end up running away, which they do two times in this issue. And they did it a couple times last issue. I think this is like the third or fourth time they've run away in the storyline, by the way.
Yeah. Well, in this issue, I think they say, oh, we've got to run away. And then it cuts to something else. And then 6 pages later, they're fighting again. And Captain Atom says, oh, we got to run away.
Exactly.
So that was also part of it, too.
So I don't know whether his indecision and them running away and all that, I don't know whether that's just a flaw in the script or whether they're trying to make us question his leadership ability. You know, I'm wondering if maybe that's what we're supposed to be doing is questioning that. I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that. And they did build up, like when he first got the leadership, he's like, I don't know if I'm ready for this. Like, I don't quite know what to do. So they did kind of set up that he's kind of like that. But I also feel like he was in the military for so long that maybe he should kind of be a natural leader anyways. But
well, and he's grown quite a bit since the beginning of this series. Now, the flip side, and this is, I'm sure this has nothing to do with it, but in the flip, you know, we could retcon to some extent and say, well, you know, there is a certain major crossover that's about to start next month, actually, where Captain Atom was supposed to be changed forever. He didn't necessarily get changed because they pulled the plug at the last minute in Armageddon 2001, but could they have been starting to set up, you know, Captain Atom beginning to fall apart? I suppose. I doubt that's what's going on here, but yeah, we could retcon it to say so.
Hey, I'm on board for it. Let's take it to DC.
Sure thing. We can do that. All right.
Yeah. But other than that, like I said, it was fun. It just didn't feel like the big climax that they had set up for. But other than that, like there was some fun moments of it. I like Kilowog really comes across as knowledgeable and not just, usually he's shown as like, hey, I'm the tech guy that fixes all the techie things. But this, he was more like applying knowledge that he had learned in, what was that book called? Whatever he was reading about the starfish.
Right. It was about marine. Let me see here. Because I actually really like that they spent the time to do that. You know, he took the time to do the research, which is hysterical. Oh, those amazing marine organisms.
Yeah. Just so happened to have that book in the New York Embassy. That's great.
Now, I have a criticism in there as well. Not that he's reading the book, because that's being useful, but the fact that the JLA has no notes on how to fight Starro. They don't, you know, they don't have the files. I mean, it just goes to prove that out of the entire Justice League franchise, the only one who's worth a damn is Catherine Colbert. Because in the first issue of this storyline, when Starro showed up, she went to the database right away and looked up Starro. No one else bothered to. So once again, a point for Catherine.
Are you sure that's not just a bias coming into this?
Oh, she's smoking hot, but okay, she's also smoking smart, too.
There we go. Well, I thought it was also, isn't JLA supposed to be a bunch of incompetent boobs anyways?
Incompetent boobs who can still manage to save the day, though.
Yeah, but why would they have information on Starro? We beat them once. We don't need to worry about that.
I guess. Well, I mean, if Catherine's able to access it, they are, too. They just didn't think of it, I suppose.
That's true. I get that.
Yeah.
But they did have that book about those amazing marine organisms.
Apparently, they've got a great, great library. So, yeah. You talked about the fights earlier. There was a couple things in the fights I liked. There's a great shot on page 13, which is all of them fighting the heroes of the Starro Control Justice Leaguers, and then, you know, our three that are free: Captain Atom, Rocket Red, and Metamorpho. And there's actually a dust up, a giant dust cloud, like and it almost looks like a Looney Tunes cartoon fight. You know, it's just like where you've got everyone's fighting and fists are flailing and it just makes a giant poof of smoke. And I love that.
And hands coming out and one leg's coming out. Yeah, I definitely see that. That's pretty funny. And then, of course, the very next panel, it shows like the result of that dust up.
Yeah.
And it's just got Ralph just tied around everybody. It's just like a big, giant, terrible rubber band that's been mixed up with everything else.
Yeah. Well, I said it last month that the Justice League members are never more competent than when they're being controlled by somebody else. When they're being controlled by somebody else, they're dangerous. They use their powers effectively. They're really a force to be reckoned with. It's when they're on their own, they seem to forget how powerful they are.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things, too, is, you know, the heroes are scared to hurt their friends, right? I mean, they don't want to do that. They don't want to injure anyone. Well, I noticed on my second reread that on page 9, Rocket Red is done giving a crap because everyone else is, like, being careful and maybe doing some gentle punching. He straight up blasts Elongated Man. He just blam. And I hadn't noticed that the first read through, and I'm like, okay, I guess he's made his decision about who can live and who can die. I'm sorry, Ralph, you're out, buddy.
Well, I guess he knows that he's made of rubber. He can take it.
Possibly, maybe.
But no, I agree with you. Yeah, because the issue is really setting up Captain Atom's feelings. Like, guys, we got to run. And the other two, Metamorpho and Rocket Red, are kind of, I don't want to say submissive, but they're at least going. They're asking Captain Atom, like, what do we do? Kind of idea. you. Mm-hmm. But like you said, in that one panel, Rocket Red's just like, I'm done. You guys, I'm done running. Let's just start blasting things.
Well, he's probably thinking about trying to save his wife and kids. You know, he's got a family man there.
I love, there was one just like a one-liner that I liked too, that when Kilowog first appears in the New York embassy out of the tube, mm-hmm. before you even see him, you get a panel of outside the embassy and you see this like sound effect of, you know, that's the tube operating. And then it sort of cuts to Beetle and Guy just starts going, ah, nerds. And it's N-E-R-T-Z.
Right.
Sorry, did you understand that? N-E-R-T-Z.
I watch enough British television to understand what that means. Yeah, so I didn't even think it blink for a second. I was thinking Zed cars right there. So yeah. The way the letter has done, he's actually given a little wobbliness to Nerds, so it looks funny. And then right afterwards, Guy says, I was all pumped up for a fight. And when he sees Kilowog, he's like, that Joker, I'm sick of fighting. So a guy's sick of fighting Kilowog? What's up with that? I thought Guy lived for that.
Well, not only that, like, there's just this personality out there of a guy who's willing to fight anything that comes to the teleportation tubes.
Yeah.
Like, I can't wait to see who this is because I'm just going to punch him in the face.
Right. And if you put this issue in perspective with the issue we just covered for Justice League America, in this scene, you've got Guy and Blue Beetle together. Well, in the Justice League issue, America issue we just covered, you know, they fought each other in a boxing match and they hate each other. So this must take place before then. But, you know, it's a little sketchy in the timeline, I suppose, because the ending takes place simultaneously.
Yeah, it is kind of weird, but they're not together too much.
Yeah.
And they're not they're not cracking jokes with each other. So you can kind of see like maybe they still don't like each other. There's just not that warmth or anything between the two.
Yeah. And if you look too deep in all that stuff, it's just a waste of time. It's, you know, this is Justice League Europe. So don't get hung up on what's going on in America until you get to something like Breakdowns, where it is issue by issue continuations.
Exactly. Yeah.
Another note real quick, Blue Jay, you know, we've been speculating whether if Blue Jay was taken over, if the Starros would shrink with him or not. And this issue proves that the Starros do in fact shrink with Blue Jay when he shrinks. So I can sleep better at night knowing that.
Well, I thought the idea too, wasn't it? Like, as soon as the Starro goes on you, it gets all that power, very much like at the very start where as John Jones, he's going, sweet, sweet power.
Right.
So he's definitely got whatever Martian Manhunter's got. So I would assume, yeah, with Blue Jay, he would get whatever Blue Jay's got.
That makes sense. Now, as a parent, like myself, I love the bit, and I hope you do too, with Manga Khan, when he's there and he's there to get the starfish, and the fridge is covered with little drawings done by clearly Rocket Red's children. I thought that was adorable.
Yeah, I love that too. And a note for to change the cat box.
Yes, it's Inspector Camus who wrote that note too. Yeah. and it seems, I don't know, there's just something so weird about Manga Khan rooting through somebody's freezer. You know, he's pulling out the starfish and in there is, you know, ice cream and fish sticks and, you know, whatever else is there that we can't quite read. It's just so domestic and yet bizarre, you know. I love the contrast.
Well, and yeah, if you think about it too, it's he just came down and knocked on the door and Captain Adams is like, yeah, it's in the freezer, go get it. He's
right.
Not even like, here it is in this containment unit that we want to make sure Starro doesn't get out of. It's just in the freezer, just go get it.
Right
beside the ice cream, can't miss it.
It is a Justice League style thing. Yeah, Captain Adam looks about as relaxed as he can possibly be, leaning up against the wall, his arms are crossed, legs are crossed. Yeah. Yeah. I am curious if the Manga Khan favor pays off, like if maybe that's going to happen in Breakdowns. Now, I haven't read ahead on Breakdown, so I don't know. But I'll be interested to see if that does come back into play at some point.
Yeah, me too. Like, I do remember reading all these issues when they first came out, but my memory is super sketchy. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing if this does pay off or not.
So, a little bit of sad news that I realized just moments before we started recording, that this is, in fact, the last issue featuring Bart Sears as the regular penciler.
Oh, man.
He'll do some more covers, but this is the last time that I'm aware of that Bart will grace the inside of the book, at least. He may have came back at some point, but at least through the end of the Giffen DeMatteis era. So it's very sad.
definitely. Well, and with breakdowns, the advertisement for breakdowns too, that was a visceral gut punch, because like I said, I don't really remember the issues per se, but I remember the sort of the overall storyline, and it was such a gut punch. So having seen that, and now knowing that Bart Sears isn't coming back, that's just unfortunate.
You know, looking in the letters page, there is some synchronicity here. There is an ad for the Batman Legends of the Dark Knight story written by Mike W. Barr and penciled by Bart Sears. So yeah. Clearly they're trying to, you know, bank on the people who like this book going over to read Legends of the Dark Knight.
Definitely, for sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of the letter pages, that was the other thing. There was just one guy, what was his name? Mark Phillips from Johnson City, Tennessee. He just starts with the Dear English Muffins.
Wow. That's a way to get their attention. I mean, that was the key when you were a letter hack, is you had to get the attention of the editor quickly. So I guess that's a good way to do it.
I did write, like, I think maybe two letters to comics in my lifetime. And that was definitely the key, was try to be funny or weird or just get noticed. And I do remember one of them was I wrote into Gru, and it was so weird that Mark Evan Year just said, yeah, I'm not touching this one.
Oh! I had a gimmick where I like made my own stationery, which had like this little Batman silhouette, which was that one Bob Kane drew for the movie, but he ripped it off of Todd McFarlane. So anyway, I made my own stationery, and I would Xerox copy it on like a color, like a light blue or something like that, so that it was unusual, so that every time I typed up a letter, it would have something that would make it stand out. So they're hoping the editor would actually, you know, take the time to at least look at it. And I did get quite a few printed back then when I was a letter hack. So it made me happy to see my name in print, because my ego is enormous, and now I have a podcast for the same reason.
There you go. Well, just in the last year, I think I bought a pack of Dr. Fate that was like the first 10 or 12 issues or something of that ongoing series in the 80s that happened just after the miniseries.
Yeah.
And I did notice a certain Shag Matthews letter got printed in one of those.
Some of the later issues, I think Stuart Moore, the editor, was pretty desperate for letters, because he printed me a lot in Dr. Fate. And once you develop that rapport with an editor who prints your letters, you're like, you know, okay, I'm sending one every month now.
Definitely. Or once you develop a rapport with a certain podcaster, you start appearing on all these shows.
It's your first time, kid. Don't get cocky. So we mentioned Bart Sears is off the book. However, I did a little research to find out who's coming on board next issue. And it's some guy named Derek Robertson, who's going to finish out this era for us with Giffen and DeMatteis. I know him as the guy who came onto my beloved New Warriors book. Apparently, he drew something called Transmetropolitan and something called The Boys. I don't know. I've never heard of that. I don't know. I don't think it went anywhere.
No, but, I don't think he's got a career.
Not at all. Not at all. So I do look forward to seeing that, though, and just from where he started. Because, I mean, that was very early in his career when he did these Justice League issues.
I was just about to ask, would that have been like one of his first probably North American jobs?
It was one of his first published things. Yeah. At least according to like Mike's Amazing World and things like that. There could have been a whole bunch that he did before that. But as far as mainstream comics, it was some of his earliest work. So it'll be fun to talk about.
Nice. I mean, this isn't about the issue itself, but some of the ads in here too also take me back.
Sure. Like
the Atari Lynx. Oh man, only $99.95. Are you kidding me? So cheap.
Somebody actually bought that. Okay. All right. were you an Atari Lynx guy?
I definitely was not, because we could not afford $99.95 American.
Okay.
But I definitely knew a guy at school that he was an only child. And when you went into his bedroom, like he had everything, right? He had the Jaguar. He had the TurboGrafx-16.
Oh, yeah.
And he had so he had this. And so I got to play on it for a little bit. And it was fun. But,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Went through batteries like no tomorrow.
Was this before the Game Boy or whatever Nintendo had for? Wasn't that Game Boy is the one I remember? I think I remember the most, but I don't know.
Yeah, the Game Boy was the original Game Boy. The green and black screen was, I think, the first one. I think the whole deal with this was that it was in color
and
it could be left or right handed if you look at the buttons, because the buttons are kind of symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
So you could flip it around if you wanted to, if you're a lefty.
Oh, that's pretty snazzy. Okay, nice. Yeah.
And the screen would rotate for you.
All right. And you could play your Paperboy and Road Blasters, man.
You better believe it. And Rygar. Oh, I loved Rygar so much.
You're talking to yourself now. But so there's another ad in here that I know you're excited to talk about, that I am as well, something I adore. So what you got?
Well, it might have just been the start of a certain comic series in the brand of Impact Comics.
Woohoo!
with the comet and the fly and the shield. And oh man, I loved all those. I loved it because it was like, it was a throwback to sort of a golden age of comics, but they tried to make it contemporary, especially with like the web, where it says here, this is a world spanning super secret organization charged with keeping the peace and keeping tabs on all the new costume heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a favorite?
I was a big fan of the Comet and the Fly. Those were my jams. And Jaguar, actually. Like, I bought Jaguar expecting not to like. I bought all of them at first and knew I'd find ones to, sort of like the new universe. I'd find the ones I liked and stick with them. And didn't expect Jaguar to be one that I loved, but I really liked Jaguar as well. So it was Comet, Fly, and Jaguar. And I loved the whole concept behind Impact. It was so exciting. Because you're right. It had that sort of, I didn't see Golden Age vibe. I saw like a Silver Age vibe. I got that same energy out of like when Marvel Comics started. You know, here's this whole wide universe. It's not just one hero, but look, it's a whole universe of characters. And it was so exciting for me. And I loved that whole being in on the ground floor of a new universe anyway. Like I loved it here with Impact. I loved it with the Ultraverse. You know, I was always looking for my next new universe or whatever. And so I found this super exciting. And it was also one of the chances I got to talk to creators for the first time. Like I talked to Mark Waid about Impact when he was working on it. And he was an editor at the time on it, and he was blown away that someone wanted to talk to the editor about the books, and not knowing, you know, that I would love everything he writes soon afterwards. But it's an exciting time for me, and I love these books.
Yeah, I wonder too if that, like, I'm the same with you, like getting on the ground floor, but this is also 1991, where the whole speculator market is coming into being and buying, getting the first issue and getting like 10 of those first issues because they're going to be worth money someday. I really felt like it was the start of that. And I was the same as you. I was like, oh, I can get issue number one of something. Oh, this is going to be awesome.
I'm sure there's some guy that's got 50 copies of The Web sitting at home and he's crying on top of them right now.
Oh, someday, those are going to be worth something.
All right. We don't need to spend all our time talking about Impact Comics because we've got that coming up on Who's Who at some point to cover all of that. But now, my friend, this is the point where we have to make the tough decision. This is where we are going to nominate the One Punch Award. All right, now we are going to nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it be fantastic or shocking or dramatic or funny or awe-inspiring or whatever. Both myself and Mike are going to pick one moment, and only one's going to be awarded the coveted One Punch Award. Mike, you're the guest, so you get to go first. What is your pick for the One Punch Award?
I don't know why you're saying this is such a tough decision, because it's clearly the one that I chose is going to be the right one, right?
I mean, come on. I guess we'll find out, won't we?
Well, what I liked was like just the setup of Manga Con going through the freezer and getting the Starro out, and Captain Adam's just like, yeah, you just go take it. But Mega Khan has one complaint, and he says, there is one thing though, address me as Khan. And then my favorite point is Captain Adam saying, yeah, right, once a conqueror of worlds, always a conqueror of worlds.
That is a fantastic moment. And it's not often that the guest and I pick the same moment, but this is one of those rare moments. I will tell, congratulations, by the way. So I will tell you the runner-ups I had. I was looking at the page before with Martian Manhunter. It wasn't so much the fact where he got frozen, because, you know, that isn't something we really talked about in the issue. We except in our recaps, is that it happens so suddenly that the Starros were taken out after three issues long, and they really have the upper hand, and they're, you know, pretty much have won the day, except Ice shows up and freezes Martian Manhunter's face in one page. So it ended way abruptly. So I didn't love that part. But the page before that, just the hulking size of Martian Manhunter with that star on his face, like he's so big he has to crouch over just to fit in the panel. Like it looks really amazing. I like that. And then the other option was Catherine Colbert in her pajamas. That was a pretty big draw for me, but I figured I better not vote for that.
Yeah. Well, and the problem with this one is, like we had kind of mentioned the recap, it was an interesting story, but not a lot happened. And there wasn't really a lot of funny moments or just wow, those kind of moments to it. But I agree with you, that Martian Manhunter one, and the way that Sears draws him with like the veins popping out of his arms.
Yeah.
He really makes him scary with the Starro on him.
Yeah, it's really exceptional. So, which again, the next page where Starro's beaten in, you know, two panels is a little disappointing, but either way, it was super fun issue, and I'm so glad we picked the same moment. So congratulations to MangaCon. You are the winner of the One Punch Award. Please wear it with pride as you shuffle through the freezer, and that award is as tangible as our love for that moment. All right, now, Mike, I need to ask a favor, if you don't mind.
Sure, what's up?
Would you mind helping around the embassy and kind of all over London to help kind of clean up all the discarded Starros? I mean, I know they claimed they're all going to dissolve, but I bet there's still some left over at that odd seafood warehouse, you know, in the comic, and it's probably pretty nasty.
Oh, man, I just cleaned up this embassy. All right, you know what? No worries. I'll do it. But you know what? This time, I better be paid in Canadian dollars, real Canadian dollars, not that Monopoly money you gave me last time.
All right. Well, don't worry, Mike. We will bring you back at the end of the show. Well, Mike's taking care of that for us, folks. I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called
Justice Log.
All right, we're about to get to your feedback. Remember, get out on the social media and tag us at JLI Podcast. As I always say, it's about building a community of online JLI fans around the show. And remember, when you're posting your comments, if you're outside of the United States, let me know, because we will assign you the appropriate embassy. And more on that in just a bit. All right, so we are going to get into your comments specifically from our website, email, social media, just from anywhere I could find it. And I'm just pulling bits and pieces of what you guys wrote, because if I were to do everything, I have 23 pages of feedback collected into a Google Doc, and that's insane! So I'm just going to be reading different bits. And for now, we're going to be covering the most recent episode featuring Justice League America number 51 with my guest Jonathan Riddle, and Justice League Europe number 27 with my guest John Coos. First up is Brento3000. He writes, "Hey Shag, another great episode. Takes me back to reading these all those years ago. Love the whole discussion around Kara, or is that Kara? And you know what, Brent? In historical fashion, I have already forgotten the correct pronunciation of her name, so I'll probably end up defaulting to Kara. Anyway, Brent goes on to say, I love that you do it. However, I wanted to raise something with you about how you recognize your international audience. I've noticed that the US, French, and British message board responders get embassies in actual cities, New York, Paris, and London, whilst other nationalities only get countries like the Scottish embassy or the Australian embassy. I am sure the Australian JLI embassy would be located in Canberra. It was even stated as such with the Tasmanian Devil in a JLI issue. And the Scottish one, I imagine, would be in Edinburgh. Do you reckon in the future you might be able to locate some of the embassies in the actual cities and not just somewhere in Scotland? Just a suggestion to be a bit more inclusive." And it was signed Brento3000 from the Canberra embassy. Well, all right, Brento, first of all, thank you so much for enjoying the fact that I do the embassies. I think that's great that someone's enjoying it besides me. And to get a little more granular here. So, all right, as far as mentioning the actual cities, specifically Paris, London, and New York, that comes from the comics themselves. You know, in the JLE and JLA comics we're reading, those are where the embassies are located in those specific comics. Those aren't real people. They're not feedbackers. So I'm fine saying, you know, New York embassy and London embassy and things like that. As far as the people that actually comment, I may be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure I always say the country for the commenters. You know, there might have been some occasions where I said, like, UK embassy, or I made a joke, I know, one time about saying the Kentucky embassy, but I'm pretty sure in most cases I just say the name of the country. And I do that for a reason. I don't really want to assign this specific city of that because, you know, for example, Paul Hicks, also from the Australian embassy, if I were to say the Canberra embassy, he'd be up in arms because he'd be like, wait a minute, I live in Granny Gut, Australia. Why aren't you crediting the actual city I live in? So that would be a bit of an issue. So again, I super appreciate your enthusiasm, but I'm going to continue to say the country. But what I will do is I will try to be more sure that I do say the country. Again, with the exception of when I talk about the comic itself, I will still reference the specific city for that embassy. But if I'm talking about the commenters, I will do everything in my power just to mention the country. For example, our next listener is Jeremy Patrick from our Australian embassy. Jeremy says, "There I am, Christmas holidays, free time on my hands, and a fantastic sushi restaurant just waiting for my business. But it's a well-known fact that I can't eat sushi unless I have JLI comics, and I can't dig out my JLI comics unless there's a corresponding episode of the podcast that drops. Will this be a sushi-free non-festive season? No, because suddenly my podcast feed updates, and a new episode is out. And not only that, it demands that I read two comics. Beetle's face when Elrond delivers the news of the arrest is priceless, and the sushi is divine. Maybe the beer helped. And that's how Shag saved Christmas." Well, thank you so much, Jeremy. I appreciate it. Then we heard from Paul Hicks from the Australian Embassy, or I could say the Granny Gut Embassy. He does shows such as Waiting for Doom and DC OCD, which I was just a guest on, actually, this week, specifically covering a bracket of the biggest DC events. We had an absolute blast. It came to blows, and friendships were destroyed. So, anyway, Paul just says, good episode, good guests, goodbye. Well, thanks, Paul. Next, I want to give a shout-out to Matt Rodriguez. He baked cookies all through December and posted pictures all over Facebook of them. He was baking DC superhero cookies, including a whole lot of JLI members, and they were awesome, Matt, and they looked delicious. Then we heard from our buddy Jeff R. Jeff is fantastic. He writes into our Who's Who show and always helps us out with the specifics, and here he came back with a correction for me. Because when I was talking to John Coos, I mentioned about Firestorm and Power Girl kind of almost hooked up but didn't. Jeff corrects me and says Firestorm and Power Girl absolutely hooked up at the end of Crisis on Earth Prime, the last JSA-JLA crossover during the time. After the entire story was over, like all Predegaton stories, it was a race from time, and the teams enjoyed, as far as they know, their only crisis-free get-together. The story ends with Firestorm and Power Girl about to commence some age-appropriate canoodling. Well, thank you for that corrections, Jeff. Then we heard from Tim Price, who's from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl to Huntress podcast, and our official JLI historian. Tim says, JLA number 51 is absolutely hilarious, right up there with Moving Day and Date with Density, part 1 and 2. He says, Adam Hughes' artwork is phenomenal as always. I especially love his take on Nort as a human. It's just fun and silly. Then Tim continues. He says, on the final page, a Dr. Kafka is mentioned as referring Black Hand to a sanitarium. So what's the big deal about that? Well, J.M. DeMatteis introduces a reoccurring character in his run on Spectacular Spider-Man, the psychiatrist Dr. Ashley Kafka. And J.M.'s run starts with issue 178, which comes out 1 month after JLI 51. So this makes a Spider fan very happy. So I got to ask him, does that make JLA 51 the first appearance of Dr. Kafka? Makes you wonder. Then on to Justice League Europe number 27, we had posed the question, had the Justice League Europe ever bailed out the JLA? And according to Tim's recollection, he would say no, but with an asterisk. He says there's no story in either monthly series where the JLE rode to the rescue of the JLA. However, in Justice League Quarterly number 1 and 2, there are some dangerous situations, and the JLA is the point team in the story, but pulls in some JLE members to assist. That is a lot closer to a JLE bailout if we say the JLA couldn't handle the problem on their own. Well, thank you, Tim. I appreciate that history. And he says, it is interesting to notice that Power Girl's Atlantean origin is not referenced directly in Justice League Europe. He says, I will offer that Justice League Europe number 1 has Power Girl mention the Lords of Chaos, which she fought in her 1980s miniseries by Paul Kupperberg, and was using her now mystical background as a through line to the Chaos Lords. That's the only mention I can think of, and it's like 2 degrees of separation from saying she's Arion's granddaughter. And then finally, Tim ends with such top-notch guests and discussion. Aw, fantastic. Thank you, Tim. Then we go to Gus Casals from our Argentina embassy. He does shows such as the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later podcast. He says, love this episode. 2 great guests for 2 great issues. Regarding the JLA, he comments about Adam Hughes. He says, I have to thank you guys for also pointing out all the little details because it really pays off and makes for a better rounded experience. Hey, Gus, I can't take any credit for that. That was all Jonathan Riddle and his amazing eye for art and just explaining how the art worked. And he really did an amazing job there. Then regarding Justice League Europe, Gus says, I love the plot twist in which Justice League Europe members could not get possessed, be it for their skin or whatever. It really heightens the tension and the interactions amongst characters that usually don't connect that way. Now, I agree, Gus. It was really interesting to see Captain Atom, Metamorpho, and Rocket Red together, working together in that way. Then we're from Gene Hendricks, who's the executive director at Azir Voices. Gene was a little confused about the guest names, so either way, glad you stopped by, Gene. Heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz comments on the art for the story, of course, is spectacular. And then Liz drops some real-world experience regarding one of the things we talked about. So you may recall, we talked about a background panel that showed a waitress who was blowing bubbles of gum, and her manager was chewing her out in this really high-end restaurant. Well, Liz writes, well, for such a high-end restaurant, this waitress is extremely lucky. Having worked as a busser at a racetrack, I can tell you that if you had gum, you would be sent home and not called back, at least for a day or two. We had one waitress who showed up in black jeans instead of the required black slacks. The lady in charge of everything sent her home. So the fact that the maitre d' is just talking to this woman in such a high-end restaurant is a little far-fetched. She darn sure wouldn't have a smirk on her face while blowing bubbles in front of her boss. Well, thank you, Liz. We appreciate that real-world insight. Then we hear from Bucky749, a.k.a. the American Samurai, who also has his own YouTube channel. Bucky says, another great episode and another pair of, dare I say, great guests. And then Bucky says, as for the musical Cats, yeah, it's boring. I think Nort most likely made it better. But seriously, whose idea was it to see Cats? You know, Bucky, I'm not sure, but I would say Martian Manhunter is probably the only cultured one of that group, so maybe it was his idea. Then we hear from Symbol Pending from our England embassy. Symbol Pending, of course, runs the Symbol Pending Power Girl blog. They say, I ask, nay, demand a chance to defend my honor. Though I definitely draw some comfort in that apparently I am now the go-to expert in all things Power Girl. I don't think I've heard my name dropped so many times in an episode. Then Symbol says, looking at the ship names from the manifest, all of those are meant to be starfish and water-related references. We have the Star, as in starfish, and Libertad, which is Liberty, which is something the hosts lack. And I had to look it up, but Daphne was a water nymph. Wow, look at you with the research, Symbol Pending. Thank you so much. Then we heard from Wendy, the girlfriend of our guest last episode, Jonathan Riddle. Wendy says, this was awesome. This was my first comic book podcast, and I absolutely loved it. The descriptions, the history, and most importantly, the voices Jonathan does. It made me feel like I was snuggled up against him while he reads to me. I think I see another fun activity for us to share. Aw, well, that's awesome, Wendy, and I'm so glad you took the time to listen. Thank you so much. And then Jennifer G. also commented in saying, my first as well. Absolutely fabulous. Well, thank you both for checking out the show, and Jonathan is clearly a lucky guy. Then we heard from my buddy Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark calls me out. He says, I'm disappointed. In this section of the discussion of Justice League America number 51 that specifically references the one punch incident, the sound effect wasn't even used once. We expect better. Ugh. All right, Mark. Good call. You caught me there, and I sincerely apologize to you listeners at home for me dropping the ball. And tell you what, let's do something different here. For those of you diehard listeners still listening through the feedback section right now, I want you to know that you, yes you, are the absolute best. Now, as a reward for staying listening, I've got a special treat for you. For this episode and this episode only, I want you to go out to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI, and leave a comment on this episode, episode 52, saying just the words, one punch. That's it. Now, by the way, I am going to say one punch a few more times here, and no, I'm not going to drop the damn sound effect in each time. It's really a pain, so don't get on my case, nerds. But again, so in this case only, I want you to go out to the website, type one punch into a comment, and submit it. Don't put anything else in it. And if you do this, I will give you a shout out at the beginning of the next episode. In order to make the deadline, which gives me enough time to record the feedback and put it in the episode, I'm going to have to make the cutoff February 12th. So get it in before then. Now, you can still leave your normal feedback. Please do. But do that in a separate comment. So again, go to the website, just a comment that says one punch, and you will get a shout out at the beginning of the next episode. And look, some folks are going to read the comments without listening to this section, and they're going to wonder, what's with all the weird one punch comments? Do not explain it to them. If they didn't listen to this section like you awesome people did, then they can just find out next month. You, and just you, are the true one punch warriors. All right, let's get back into your feedback. So we heard from Doug Adamson from our Scottish embassy. Doug says, your guests really shined this month. Regarding JLA, he says, from here on in, including the boxing match, the darkness begins to creep further and further in from the edges as Breakdowns comes along. But this issue has none of it, and it was pure joy and fun all the way, without the crazy Booster Beetle scheme at all. It showed how great a comedy all the characters could be if placed in just the right situation. You know, that's a great point, Doug. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, Beetle and Booster were not part of the scheme this time. They just got to sat back and laugh at everybody else. So yeah, that's pretty great. Then regarding Justice League Europe, he says, however, that issue felt like an invasion of the Body Snatchers. And man, that worked really well as a tale. I don't think JLA could have done this story as well, but the more action-adventure tone of JLE felt right. And then he says, as to your two guests, Mr. Riddle brought amazing insight into how the art worked. I have to admit, I'm no expert at seeing the depth in design and layout, but I know what I like, and having someone explain to me why I liked it is brilliant. It made us all feel a little smarter. Kudos for that, and I hope to hear Mr. Riddle's return. Then he says, Mr. Koos brought a lot of energy to this episode and his love of Power Girl. And then he says, and the debate as to how to pronounce her name, for the record, it's Kara, as I did, because my daughter is named after her. And then about John Koos, Doug says, I know he is someone who just found the podcast, but he does sound like he's been part of the rotation for years. How does one do that? It's a skill and a reflection of a happy and engaging personality. Doug's full of the compliments here. You think he's trying to get on somebody's good side? I don't know. Wow. And then he says, when are the tickets in the John Koos versus Symbol Pending battle going on sale? John Coos followed up, and John, of course, from the quintessential Gen X 80s podcast with John and Scott. John says, yes, there's clearly a Cold War developing between myself and Symbol Pending. I do give great respect to that individual's passion for DC's most misunderstood character. We understand her and love her deeply. Yeah, it's definitely brewing between Symbol Pending and John Coos. And don't worry, folks, I am making arrangements to ensure Symbol Pending gets a chance to defend their honor. All right, and then John went on to say, and check this out, as I quote, John says, Shag is right again. John explains, he goes on to talk about how he tried out panel-by-panel mode in reading digital comics, and after giving me heck for it, he has now come around and thinks it's awesome. In fact, he and I have had some nice side conversations about it as well. Yeah, folks, I mean, panel-by-panel mode, I'm telling you, it is the way to go. It will change the way you read digital comics forever. Anyway, then we heard from Diablo Frank from the Rollspine Podcast Network. He does the Martian Manhunter blog, Idlehead of Diablo, and so much more. Frank says, glad the synopsis was useful. What he's saying there is I borrowed his synopsis of one of the issues last month that he had written for his blog because it was very helpful. Anyway, he says, glad the synopsis was useful. I did a bunch of favorite Martian Manhunter stories for the blog after the hero was killed off in Final Crisis, so I can co-sign on the positive sentiment here. And then Frank thanked me for playing his Dark Horse Presents Aliens promo on the episode. Well, I'm happy to do it, Frank. Absolutely. Always happy to support your show and other people's. In fact, folks, if you do a podcast and you have a promo of your own, and I'm not already playing it, or it's not part of our library of podcast promos to play, please let me know, because we do have a resource we use to play promos of other podcasts. I would love to add your show, your promo, to our rotation. All right, then we hear from Randy Caldwell. Last episode, in Justice League Europe, you may remember I talked about four different panels. It talked about planes, trains, and automobiles transporting various starfish. And the one with trains said freight, and the ones with airplanes also said freight. And I suggested that the plane one was a mistake and it should have said flight rather than freight. Well, Randy calls me out on this. He says, not to be that person, but I know my role in these things. Well, actually, they may be more likely to mean freight in Justice League Europe number 27, since the wee Starros could fit on cargo planes better than passenger planes. You may be right. It could be the case. I just thought it would make more sense with freight being for trains and flights being for planes, but, you know, hey, six of one, half dozen of the other, maybe you're right. They were from Martin Gray from our Scottish embassy. He does the Two Dangers for Girl blog. Martin says, Nort did not ruin Cats. Cats was born terrible. And there is no worse song in that horror of a show than Gus the Theatrical Cat. Bucky 749, the American Samurai, comes in to defend Cats. Meanwhile, Siskoids from the Canadian embassy, part of our Fire and Water podcast network, does shows such as Who's Editing and More, says, well, when one puts their dog expectations on cats, cats will seem bad. But when one puts their cat expectations on dogs, dogs will seem dumb. That's just the way it is. You can guess Siskoid is a cat person. Then we heard from Jason Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and now Time Problems. Jason says, Justice League America number 51 is a comic I completely had forgotten about until a few years ago when I pulled out the floppies as I was reading straight through them. The issue was great. So many of the lines in this one cracked me up. He also mentions he likes the grouping of the three alien members of the JLI being united kind of around their commonality of being only one of their kind on Earth, even though they're all very different personalities. You know, Jason, you made me think of that. I hadn't put two and two together that last issue we had an aliens issue. This issue, the Alien Registration Act, is kind of coming about. Maybe there's a connection. Curse you, Nort, messing up cats. Then we heard from Brett Young from Imagine 8 Design. He says, great show, Shag. I finally caught up with every episode of the JLI podcast and thought I'd chime in. I love these series growing up, and I started with issue number one right after Legends and never looked back until it got too extreme. Brett says he's always wonderful to revisit Adam Hughes' art, and John Riddle did a remarkable job of breaking down the hows and whys of Hughes' storytelling in an easy-to-understand way. If he hasn't already, Jonathan should consider teaching art. Brett, I completely agree. Jonathan absolutely has the knack for teaching art. In fact, Wendy, his girlfriend, chimed in agreeing with you. And then one last thing Brett said, he goes, one thing about the JLI embassy is that there's an alarming amount of doilies around. Between those and the reclining grandpa chairs with the pullback handles, I think Maxwell Lord hired my Nana as an interior decorator. I was looking for a love seat with a plastic cover on it. You are not wrong. Oh my gosh, there are an insane amount of doilies in the embassy, Brett. I'm glad you noticed that. All right, folks. Well, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared the JLI podcast on their social media timeline, specifically Facebook and Twitter. Again, I know it. I know it's a long list of names. It's not a surprise to me, folks, and it shouldn't be to you either. But these folks showed their support and promoted the show. So it's really important to me that we recognize these individuals each episode. So here's everyone who helped promote the last episode by sharing on Facebook or retweeting on Twitter. You know, you could be on this list. It's not hard. So our thanks go out to Al Girding, Andre TFG, Between the Pages blog, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook group, Brian Schufo, Canadian Geek, Changing Shades, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Christopher Luke, Coffee and Comics, Doug Adamson, Dr. Ange, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Ed Moore, Frederico Hernandez, Geek to Me Radio, Jake Muir, Jason R. Lady, Joe Tonello, John Coos, John Reads Comics, Justin Steiner, Keith G. Baker, Liz Ann Oswald, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matthew Cody and his Superman Radio Revisited podcast, Maz Anger 1978, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mick Jameson, Mike Dinas, Mo Walker, Noise Guys, Motion Picture Podcast, Paul Kean, Pragmatic Gollum, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Pulp Fiction Comic... I thought I could get through it. Pulp Fiction Comics, Culver City, Randy Caldwell, Rob Kelly and his accounts for For All Mankind, Super Friends Podcast, Mountain Comics, and Treasury Comics, Rolled Spine Podcast, Sen Goku, Siskoid, Steve Gibbons, Symbol Pending, Tim Price and his Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders Podcast, Trent Lewis, Turbo Comics, Willie Arbrough, Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey RPG Podcast, and Zek Cap Boots. Woof. Well, folks, thank you so much for your support of the JLI podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and this community of JLI fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Jonathan Riddle or John Coos. Just let me know, and I'll be sure to include you on the next episode. Please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. At our website is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave your comments on the show posts. Over on Facebook, you can find us at JLI Podcast or Justice League International, Wahaha Podcast. And on Twitter, we're JLI Podcast. And our email is jlipodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Jonathan Riddle and John Coos for appearing on the most recent episode of the show. And thanks to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. You guys, seriously, you are awesome. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we'll see if we can bring our guests from this episode, Joe Tonello and Mike Dinas, together in the same episode.
When you watched Batman as a kid, you enjoyed the colorful heroes and villains, the text sound effects on the screen, the thrill of watching a heroic crime fighter escaping from death traps and taking down bad guys. But the show was devised to interest adults, too. What did you miss as a kid? Sexual innuendo.
The Penguin's too small for me.
Closeted gay characters.
I like that cape, Batman.
Freudian death traps.
Has the giant clam really swallowed Robin?
Police incompetence.
Bruce Wayne is a millionaire playboy. Hardly a secret identity for Batman.
Whether you're a kid or an adult, there's something to like about our favorite caped crusader. Tim and Paul dig for the deeper meanings under the Batmania every other Thursday. What's the podcast's name?
To the Batpoles. To the Batpoles. To the Batpoles.
Superman Radio Revisited. Hosted by Matthew T. Cody. This is going to be a new podcast which will be exploring the Superman radio show of the 1940s. It will begin by playing an episode.
Unfiltered. Unedited. Uncensored. Uncut.
Followed by my commentary. We're going to talk about the era a little bit and any interesting things that crop up in the episodes. I think it'll be a lot of fun, and I'm hoping to make it an interactive show. So come along. It's going to be a great time.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, it does appear the JLI teleporter has brought both Joe and Mike together. All right. Well, first, Joe, my thanks to you, sir, for appearing on the show. You've been very patient, waiting many, many years to be here. And I appreciate your friendship. And I'm just glad that we got a chance to finally talk about this issue. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you on the interwebs or anywhere for that matter?
Oh, geez. You can find me a ton of places now, which is why I'm so happy this is being done 6 years later. I actually can fill this out quite a bit. So I actually co-host a comic media podcast called Get Bit. We are found either Thursday night or Friday nights live, just depending on when mine and my co-host Will's schedule works up. We cover all topics geek-related, so comics, anime, stuff like that. And then I pick a top five. I sneak in six or seven because he lets me. of modern comics, I give a full rundown and then my thoughts about it. And then I ask Will what his thoughts are on it. And it is a great way to keep up with new comics. I look at Marvel. I look at DC. I look at indie. You'll just never know what you can find. And I work with multiple charity groups. Again, I work with the Tennessee Ghostbusters. I work with Cosplay Collective. I work with Dad Bod Cosplay. I work with the Nashville Legion of Superheroes and Villains, Middle Tennessee API. As far as social media, on Twitter, I'm Joe Italian Last Name. You can also find me on Twitch for Joe Italian Last Name. I'll be doing a video game playthrough very soon, God willing, if life lets me. On Instagram, I'm either Nashville Scarlet Spider or Nashville Green Lantern. And I have on TikTok, you can find me on Ancient Dino Dude. I don't really post there too much, but I did just recently post the gathering of all the Stunticons for the new Transformers Legacy and a picture of the completed version of Menasport.
Awesome.
He is my favorite of the combiners right after Predaking. I think that's everywhere.
Well, that's fantastic, Joe. You are everywhere anybody wants to be. So, folks, there's no excuse why you can't find Joe out there. So, and check out his cosplay when you're looking at it, because I mean, it's so cool and what you guys are doing. I'm just totally overwhelmed. And again, thank you so much for being here. This has been a blast, man. I appreciate it.
Yep. You, me, or a regular pair. We just don't know what.
Now, Mike, I really appreciate you being on the show, and I'm so excited that this was your first podcast appearance ever. I mean, probably your last based on how your performance, but either way, I'm so excited that you chose this show to be on. So why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
Nowhere, really. No, seriously, though, I am, you know, on the regular social stuff, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Well, I guess not Twitter so much anymore because I signed up for Mastodon and Hive. I don't even know what these things I'm signing up for. But also on Discord as well as Mike Dynas. There aren't too many Dynases out there. So if you find one, it's probably me.
Well, I'm glad that we found each other, and I'm glad that you've been part of this big Fire and Water family for so long now, and that we finally got you on a show, buddy.
Oh, man, yeah, and I can't, you know, we've joked a lot, but I really can't thank you guys enough for inviting me on, and I think I started listening to you and Rob, like, around Who's Who episode 3 or 4.
Oh, my
gosh. Basically, I had a coworker who said to me, like, hey, did you know someone's doing a Who's Who podcast? And my eyes just lit up. I'm like, oh, my God, somebody else knows about this comic book? And so, yeah, I've been listening for a long time, and it took me a little while to feel comfortable to even, like, start commenting on things, but I've been doing that lately and just really enjoying it. It really blows my mind, the amazing, talented roster of hosts and guests that you guys have somewhat curated, and I just feel incredibly lucky to be even tangentially connected to this network. So you've given us nerds and geeks so much that I'm just proud to know you guys, and even if it's just in an internet friend kind of way. And I wish you guys and the network nothing but successes in the future. And even that means I'm not going to be on anymore. But now having recorded with you, I can kind of see why Rob hates you so much.
Oh, well, that tracks. That makes sense. Yeah, that's fair. I'll take that hit. Yeah, absolutely. I will say the most shocking thing that came out of this entire episode is that the Fire and Water Podcast Network actually spread by word of mouth, by one person talking to another in an office. I just figured we're all over the world, and we're all nerds in silos, and we don't know anyone else who knows this stuff. So the fact that someone in an office actually mentioned it to someone else, you know, or the water cooler talk, blows my mind.
Well, I hate to say it, but the dirty secret is I don't think you gained any listeners, because I think he pretty much turned off quite soon after that. So you had one listener and you maintained one listener.
It was that rant we made against Arrok, Son of Thunder, I guess, or something like that. I don't know. Well, thanks again, Mike. I appreciate it. And folks, that is going to do it. And come back next episode. You're going to have to wait just a little bit longer for coverage of Breakdowns, because next episode, we're going to step sideways and cover the 1991 Justice League annuals. That's right. It's 1991, and that means it's the turn of the century with Armageddon 2001. We're going to be covering Justice League America, annual number 5, plus Justice League Europe, annual number 2. And we'll have two more guest hosts to help me cover those issues. Who will they be? Come on, folks. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, I'm Shag.
I'm Joe.
And I'm Mike.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?